reconvene the meeting of the Customer Service and Operations Committee.
This is the convening of the Customer Service and Operations Committee. I would ask for approval of the agenda.
Second.
Motion made by Ms. Hines, seconded by Mr. Giancola. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? First, the approval of the minutes of May the 26th revised and June the 9th.
I'll move.
Moved by Mr. Nichols.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Giancola. Any discussion? Hearing none, I would ask for a vote of affirmation.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion to approve the minutes is approved. Yes.
Might I also go back to the agenda approval?
Yes.
That we kind of got so many things happening. We will add at time certain when Mr. Rogoff appears for the Dulles update to be a part of this agenda.
Good. I've agreed to that in our previous discussion, and
no
I understand that it would be approximately 11:30. Mr. Rogoff would be here, and I'd agreed previously that we would interrupt the committee meeting to have the CEO and general manager review the issues outstanding on the secretary's recommendation on the modification of phase two on the Silver Line. And Mr. Rogoff is here to answer any questions that might arise about the secretary's letter. Thank you for adding that. Action item number one, station naming. Ms. Richardson.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm returning to you. You'll recall that 2 months ago, as we were reviewing the station naming policy, you had asked that we go back and talk to customers to validate the policy and to get their feedback. And this is all part of our work that we're doing to get ready for Dulles, in particular the blue-yellow realignment and the design work that we have underway on our map to indicate all of the service expansion. So if you also recall that the policy had not been updated in 10 years, so it was timely that we took a look at it. Next page, please. So the research objectives when we went to talk to our customers were to validate and ask them about the current station naming policy principles. And if you'll recall, the principles are that stations should be named for geographical features, cities, community, neighborhoods, centers of activity, schools, stadiums, parks, that they be distinctive, that they evoke imagery so that they are very clear. It's all about helping customers navigate their way through our system and also through the region, and that the station names be brief. There were character limits that are in the policy. If you recall, 19 characters for stations. There are fewer characters for transfer stations, 13. We also talked to the customers about effectiveness and expectations in helping them navigate. Not only is this policy reasonable to them, but do the current names and the way that the policy is put into practice help them get around? You know, is it serving its purpose, really? We asked them for common references. As you know, we have station names that exceed the character limit. So we put before them a list of those stations, and we asked them, how do they refer to these stations? Simply, we also put before them, I think Mr. McKay asked for the list of all of the station names that have been talked about informally, formally, over time, and that list was 15 station name long, so we also put those before them is to get feedback as well. And we also took an opportunity to look at ways that we could better display the station names on the map, but also perhaps on the signage and so forth to help them navigate. And I think instead of listening to me, it is better that we all listen to our customers. And so I have a video collection.
Does this policy even make sense to you? I'm sharing with you
that I'd like
there's a policy. Step one is, what do you think of this policy? Does it make sense to you?
Logical, I think.
Excuse me?
It's logical, I think.
So it seems logical.
Okay. But the policy, if it's really actually stuck by, then it shouldn't be that far off.
Yeah.
So the policy itself makes sense. But is it really like implementing it in every case? Maybe,
so,
maybe or maybe not. But
it makes sense to me because I live here, but I do remember being on the Metro once and someone just wanted to get to the zoo and they just thought it was the hardest thing ever because they couldn't, the zoo was hidden in between Woodley Park and Adams Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it does give a great idea. Even if you're from D.C. but you're not familiar with that area, you can
mm-hmm.
immediately place
mm-hmm.
which part of town you're in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say appears to be somewhat haphazardly applied.
The huh?
policy makes sense, but the naming convention doesn't follow the policy.
Yeah, we'll get.
It makes perfect sense.
Uh-huh.
I think it's a good policy.
Yeah.
The policy seems to make
yeah.
sense.
Yes.
Okay. What is your expectation of where George Mason University is located in relation to that stop? What is the distance? What's your. Excuse me? Well, you expect it to be in walking distance? Uh huh. And what is walking distance?
15 minutes.
Take you 10 or 15 minutes to get to it? Where do you expect it to be?
It's within 10 minutes. Blocks.
Yeah, within the next block or two.
Yeah. Within a couple of blocks, a 10-minute walk?
Yeah.
Yes.
Can I go to a 15-minute walk?
No.
Like
no.
A few blocks.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a walking distance? Walking distance, a few blocks.
Even like 10 minutes tops for me.
Right.
A 5-minute walk?
Right.
Yes. A 5-minute walk.
Like if I'm a mother with two kids and a stroller and I can't get there easily, like don't put it in the title. Because it really is misleading.
Mm-hmm. Just using that as an example.
Blocks.
Within a few blocks.
Right.
Yeah.
Within a few blocks. What if it's not? What if it's a shuttle there?
It shouldn't be.
Then it's in the station
blocks.
Name.
Blocks, yeah.
Yeah, two blocks or less. A couple of blocks.
Yes.
Yeah, a couple of blocks.
I think
okay.
the zoo is probably the longest we want to walk from the metro
uh-huh.
to the actual station.
Uh-huh. After that first station, Woodley Park Zoo, Adams Morgan, how do you refer to it?
Woodley Park.
Woodley Park.
New York Ave.
Arkansas.
Rhode Island. What is it about these examples that you've given me of good names?
They help you direct. They're good directionals.
Mm-hmm.
Like Ronald Reagan Airport. I mean, it's a directional. It's exactly where you want to go. So
it lets you know exactly where you're going.
Location.
It gives you a location. It's short. One word, Robert said. What else?
Direct.
Excuse me?
No, I was just saying one or two.
One or two words, keeping it short. Okay.
Your respective landlords.
Yeah.
They're actually marking the landmark that is there.
That's
how you know that area.
Yes.
So it's a landmark characteristic.
Single names that they relate to the neighborhood, not to, they're not trying to clutter in a particular destination.
Mm-hmm.
One or two words.
Uh-huh. One or two words.
Two words max.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Accurate to its location.
Accurate to the location.
Or landmark.
Or the landmark.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I think short.
Yeah, on the shorter side of things. Uh-huh.
I think it's very specific. That's the destination right there.
Right.
Those examples that's not working.
They just need to choose a name.
They're long.
There are some of them, like Van Ness UDC, I don't have a problem with that,
mm-hmm.
but U Street, African American Civil War Memorial, Cardozo, like it's too long.
U Street, African-American Civil War Memorial Cordova.
Yes. And why is that an example?
It's very long.
And again, what's the problem with that one from your perspective?
Long.
Too long.
If you want the point of interest, put it in a different, I mean, you can allude to it without it being part of the name.
Or you can do it like we were talking about with the different fonts. U Street Cardozo, different font size, African-American Civil War Memorial. And then the cross streets, like we were discussing earlier.
You usually just say U Street. So
that's Wrigley Park Zoo, Adams Morgan. I feel sorry. I feel sorry for people who think they're going to be in Adams Morgan when they get off there.
What attributes make them weird things? The length, they're long.
I thought she was right with Farragut North, Farragut West.
Yeah, having two Farraguts, huh? A north and a west.
Okay. So those were the participants of the focus groups. We ran six focus groups over the period of June 20th to 22nd. They were a mix of frequent Metro riders, infrequent, as well as occasional. They were a big mix. They were a mix of all the jurisdictions. We did all sorts of demographics to make sure that they were pretty well balanced. Next slide, please. As you heard it from them, they like the policy. They think that it makes sense to have the principles. They want it to be brief. They're not sure what happened to the policy. In the first focus group that I observed, that I actually talked to the facilitator because it could have been a point of confusion. They thought that we were bringing a policy to them after the fact. So we made some adjustments in how we discussed it so they were aware that it had been there for a while. Go on. Next slide. Yeah. They strongly support shorter landmarks, means within walking distance. You can see the ones that they called out unprompted as effective. They are one or two words. They're very distinctive. They clearly say to the customers where they are in the system and how to get there. Those that were deemed ineffective were longer. Just become a little bit too cumbersome, and they think that, as you heard, that if something's going to be in the NIM, it needs to be pretty close to the station. You don't have to walk up and see it immediately, but it needs to be very close. Mm-hmm.
Just a quick question. Did we have any focus groups, or were there any people who were traveling through the region who were not local, who were using the system and had not use it, whether they be here on as tourists or on business, to see what their experience was, or were they 2 days to interrupt while they were doing it?
No, we did not. We didn't call in tourists. I think, you know, we could probably do that going in the future. We could probably go right to the platform level and do intercept interviews.
And that might be useful to capture people who are really having the experience of, mm-hmm. Where am I? How do I get where I want to go?
Sure. Right there.
Right there.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yep. On this, you'll see, and you heard the chanting in the one focus group, but what we simply put before them were the long names and said, how do you refer to these stations? And you heard them. They went all the way down the line. There were two exceptions. Franconia Springfield is Franconia Springfield to them. It's not just the first name. Some of these first names, I would note, also are the historical names that were the originals, so they like to stay with them. National Airport got mixed. I think you heard it a little garbled there. It's for some people, and it's probably the same in this room, it's National. For other people, it's Reagan. I will note, though, that that name has been changed, and it has been set by federal law. So it is Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. the next slide. So everyone, pretty was consistent that they want us to simplify and keep it as easy for them to figure it out as possible, and in particular on the map. The map continues to be beloved by our customers. They feel a great connection to it. So what we did, and I want to give credit to Greater Washington, they ran a contest to see how, on our mapping, what would be the best way to do some map options. And some of the contestants came up with this primary-secondary approach. And we wanted to test it, and it came out very favorable. It helped customers because it speaks to them the way they speak about the stations. New York Avenue, it becomes New York Avenue in the bold type, and then the secondary part of the station still remains on the map, but it is really, the reference point is the bold name, is the first name that they go with. They also, I would also say that they want us to continue to keep the cross streets in small type there so that they know precisely where it is on the streets. Okay. And then we tested some icons. These icons were designed by Lance Wyman some time ago when he and his partner originally designed the first map. And we did not use them at Metro, but we decided to test some of them. And they did not see them, customers didn't see them to replace names, but they thought they might be useful, used sparingly for tourist attractions to help tourists get to particular spots in the city. We also asked them about the formal names that have been submitted for the Dulles, the first stage of Dulles. There were two that were deemed effective, meaning that they could place them in their mind as to where they would be. Tyson's 1 and 2, you can see in Reston Town Center. They had difficulty placing the remainder, in part, well, maybe not all, but part of the confusion can be around the repetition and use of Tyson's and Herndon and Reston repeatedly. So we heard comments such as, it's Wheelie Avenue. Let's see, it's Spring Hill Road. so for them, they'd like a little bit more help on knowing precisely where it is in Shorten. And Herndon Dulles East, as you can see, is confusing because they see it as potentially the airport stop. And one comment from a frequent rider was, if it's not the airport, don't say Dulles. So that, I think, is useful for us to know going forward. Also, one other thing I would add while we're here, you know, we have always had the practice at Metro of showing where the next piece of the system would be opening and indicating the stations. And they had a reaction that was, if the station isn't open, don't put it on the map yet. So what I think that allows us is a little time to work with Fairfax on some of the names. So we have a little bit of time to do that. Research finding on informal proposals. Most of them were rejected. Most of the 15 or so that we tested, they did not like. And I will tell you that it's mostly because that they want to hold tight to where we are. That if, you know, it works the way, you know, keep the name shorter. You know, don't continue to add to the names just to keep adding to the names. They also see that people are using these as marketing tools, and they want to keep the names as helpful to them to navigate the system and the region. There were two exceptions. Yep.
In the policy recommendations, how does the secondary work? Like, I recognize there's a policy for the primary, you know, keep it short and try to keep it on the historic use. But does it apply in an example right there, like Navy Yard, where you put how are we deal with the national your logo? Would the secondary be Capitol Riverfront, or is there a recommendation that would not be, should not be part of the name at all?
On this list, we did not ask them on this list in particular about primary secondaries for this. Mostly we were just trying to get a reaction about to help jurisdictions know if they should move things forward or not, because I know there were a number out there. Is this good? Is this not good? So we didn't do that. We can do that. So you saw the two exceptions they thought were possible. And as, you know, Mr. Wells, as you noted, you know, for the Nationals, it could be one of the three, just to let people know it's a ballpark there. Mixed reviews on those three, and generally they oppose station naming rights, with the exception, however, if it means that their fares aren't going to go up, then they oppose it. But some of the comments, again, get back to why people feel so personally connected to the system and the names. You know, they view that as disruptive, and they don't want to have their station name change a lot as the commercial interest changes. So they always want to have their station name be what it is. And again, they're personally connected to it. Next slide. So the recommendations are, and I want to clarify that the station naming policy is a management-driven policy, but the board, as part of that policy, approves the station names. So we're interconnected, so that's why, you know, we think it's important that this be an action item, because we can have a management policy, but the board approves the names. So my recommendation is that we, in management's recommendation, is that we adhere to our policy, that we had the primary provisions about how you name the stations, the character limits, the fact that it should come from the jurisdictions to the board for approval, that we amend the policy, and I think Mrs. Hines and Mr. McKay, you raised this issue with me last time, that, you know, there is value in the customer input process, but how do we get that involved at the jurisdiction level so that the board isn't presented with names that we then have to go back? So what I would propose is that if there's a name that the jurisdictions want to consider, that they provide notice to Metro, or specifically to my department, and that we could then together do customer research, because we could be doing research here at Metro on a number of other things, and we certainly could put that in the mix. So together we research, or, you know, we do the customer research and validate and do the feedback, then goes back to the jurisdiction, then can formally bring it forward to the board for approval. So it seems as though a 120-day process could be a reasonable time frame. That we amend the policy going forward, not saying retroactively, but going forward, that the landmarks be maybe with a half a mile distance or within walking distance of a station. And station naming rights would require, as Carol O'Keefe has opined, would require board action anyway if we decide to do that, because as an advertising mechanism on a station name, they would have to come forward anyway for approval. So we would not necessarily have to name that or say it in the policy per se.
I'm sorry, Mr. Wells?
Do you make any recommendations?
There it is.
I look forward to hearing the recommendation of what your thoughts are about the secondary approach.
So I would suggest that we transition to a primary-secondary approach, that we use the next generation of the map that we're working on, which would be for the blue-yellow realignment that we're proposed to go into effect for next June, that we take the ones that we heard that were very common, the ones that the customers identified in the research, and start at that point. And that's how we would use those, except for Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport, which is legally prescribed to us, and that we would begin in June.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a good approach. I think, though, that the policy probably ought to have some guidance on how many characters in that secondary, in the same way that it has guidance on how many characters in the primary. And because you don't want us to end up with like three lines of type underneath saying all these things that we've decided are within a 10-minute walk or are important for people to understand. So I think you should come up with some parameters for us to consider.
Mr. Downing?
On the secondary names, you're focused at the moment on the map. Would this carry over to signage, to the pylons, to other things?
Well, we also have, as part of the whole signage replacement program, we have a proposal out to look at map concepting, and so I would recommend that we take that opportunity to at least design what they would look like. Going forward, unless we were planning to change out all the signs, I would leave it alone, but when we get to the point of changing out the signs, that I would suggest that we do it at that point. But I do think that we should take a look at how we, from a design perspective, how we would do it on the station signs as well as the pylons, which are so important.
Mr. Giancola?
Yes, I support the primary secondary concept. I just really like the way it looks as well. And I agree with Ms. Hines that we need to kind of limit how many lines we eventually put in for the secondary. What my concern is in some of the use of icons. I can understand the Smithsonian Castle being an icon. I can understand the ballpark being an icon. If you've gone to the Hill before, Capitol South is not the only metro stop you can get to go to the Capitol, so I would question that that would not necessarily be clear to most people who are tourists. And certainly the L'Enfant Plaza and the Federal Center one, I wouldn't have a clue what the heck I was going to there. So I would be... I would caution the use of icons and be very, very restrictive, and maybe then through the focus groups input on that. So I have a mixed feeling on the icons.
Yeah, I at this point, I'm not recommending that we would go forward with that, but we could continue to test them with the map work that we're doing, and maybe there might be a couple that would do well. But at the beginning point of this, as we transition, I would just like to move to the primary secondary to help declutter.
Okay, and I agree with that. If you look at the L'Enfant Plaza one, now, I live near Silver Spring, even though I live in the District of Columbia, and that looks like the Silver Spring artwork that you go into the southern part of Maryland and from the district. So.
And some of these are historical. They're very interesting because they go back to some historical landmarks, but they may not be immediately, as you pointed out, recognizable. So I think the first point should be primary, our focus on the primary secondaries.
Mr. McKay?
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. I think this is really good work. I like the primary, secondary. I guess the question I have, and I know the objective here is to declutter, but I'm just curious, did anyone offer any opinions about distances being a part of the map? For example, we're talking about what is walking distance, but it's pretty arbitrary. I've seen in other places where it'll say, you know, 0.1 miles, 0.2, whatever, in parentheses next to the secondary location under the station name. Was there any discussion or any value added to having some type of measurement like that?
Well, I may not understand, but they were saying it should be about 5 to 10 minutes. So I was thinking that's probably about a half a mile, six blocks at the most.
I just don't know if, you know, in the secondary names, if we want to draw an arbitrary line on distance or not, or whether we want to provide people information about what type of distance it is. I mean, to Tony's point about the Capitol, you can get off at multiple stations. When I go to the zoo, I get off at Cleveland Park because it's a better walk to the zoo from there than it is from Woodley Park Zoo. And I'm not even sure. I think, in fact, it might even be closer. So what I'm curious about is, you know, did that question even come up, or did any customers even offer that, hey, instead of, you know, making that arbitrary line, tell us how far it is from the station to the zoo from that location? And I just don't know if there's any value to asking that question or not.
No, the only way that that came up, but ultimately they decided they did not want names that you have to take a shuttle to on the signage, but they were talking about, is there some way to mark it, but I think it becomes even more confusing, and then you have to figure out, then you have to define what that means, and then there's another layer of explanation that's required. I think the better approach is just to try to make it as simple and direct and obvious is possible.
The only reason I ask that is because when I look at the primary, secondary, when I get out of the station, I ought to be at the primary, obvious.
Yeah.
And the secondary ones, by implication, means, you know, they might be a little bit further away from where you're getting off at the station. A lot of people will imply that's what that means.
Right, and we do have our neighborhood maps, you know, in the stations. And also, we have an opportunity going forward, and you'll see it, and we'll talk a minute, in the 7,000 series cars. We have an opportunity to highlight landmarks on station stops in our future, in video screens that we're going to have in every one of those cars. So I think there are other ways, to your point, of getting at those secondary names to communicate, to let people know that where you are in the landmarks.
Yeah, no, I just bring it up because I think it's important. When I look at the map, I expect that when I get out somewhere, it's what the primary name is. Yeah. And I expect the other things listed there are somewhere around there, but not necessarily right there. And I'm just putting myself in the position of someone who may not be familiar with our system at all. And looking at this now, the way Woodley Park is listed with the secondary, I look at that and say, when I get out of the station, I'm going to be smack dab middle Woodley Park, and somewhere around there is going to be the zoo. And where it's listed today, it's listed as all equals. And so I think it helps with the confusion for folks that we're implying that the secondary things are not right there. So I think we need to, when we're looking at the policy for secondary, we have to be careful that a secondary item is not where you are right when you get out of the station, and the primary name is somewhere else further away.
Okay, right. Got it.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, sorry.
I just want to follow up on Jeff's comment. I think that's a very good point about considering putting distance in for the secondaries. It's just a parenthesis, a small parenthesis. It's something to consider as you do your further research and look at this, because people will expect that even though it's secondary, that it's a very short walk away. As all the people said in the focus groups, they think it's a couple blocks. Well, Adams Morgan is not a couple blocks from the stop, and we all just recently learned that Gallaudet University is a shuttle ride away from the New York Avenue stop. And if you said, well, it's a half a mile, that would tell somebody how, you know, if you put in there 1/2 mile, small print, it would tell people how far they have to walk from the station. I think that ought to be considered.
I'm sorry. Is that Jeff?
Thank you. I want to thank you, and I really want to thank the customers, because I think this is really what we should be doing, is driving it for them. And with that in mind, I'm looking at the Dulles, and they kind of lack that same kind of, I think, the level of customer input. And I think your point that you're making with the policy is that this is the Metro's responsibility, and that going out to the jurisdictions is better than the jurisdictions coming into Metro. And so I would hope that maybe what we can do is use an opportunity based on this calendar to utilize some of that service to refine some of this. And you're really saying that we have a little bit more time to do so.
Mm-hmm. I think with the Dulles names, because we got the reaction that if the service isn't in operation today, don't put the name on the map. I think we have a little bit of room here to work on the name. So
I think room to work. Hopefully you. That's a hard one to buy in right away, because a year and a half, 2 years is a list in time. So I guess you would modify the map and think about what that cost would be.
Question in terms of Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that we have a procurement for a pylon signage type of exploration coming forward.
Well, it's part. We. It's not an exploration. When we do the blue-yellow realignment, right, we have to change out 3/4 of our station signs.
Right. Yeah. That was. I guess that was the point of my question here. But at the end of the day, when a change of any sort occurs on any station or name at any place, every aspect of signage throughout the entire system will change effective with that change, so that there will be consistency between the map the pylon, the sign, anything that is associated with direction, location with the system does change together, so that there will not be any tools that will be inconsistent with one another. Is that correct? Okay.
No.
I just want to be sure.
Probably, because there's station signs that aren't, you're not changing the station name, so the station-specific signage at the platform, et cetera, probably would not change.
So give me an example of that.
That's right. If you go to Judiciary Square, and all the sign says is Judiciary Square because that's the name of the station, that doesn't change. But if you go to the pylon, which lists the route and all the station names on that route, because there's a station on that route that's being added or something like that,
right,
that will have to be changed. So you're going to affect any place as a route map.
Okay. So, but as far
designation.
But our tools of indication for customers and everyone else will be consistent in terms of, if I look here, I see this, and if I look there, I see that, and it looks the same, correct?
Yes.
Okay. That was my, thanks.
Mr. Welch?
Yeah. Maybe we've already done this, but how do we get the menu of pricing policy that if we're going to do this now, or, you know, in order to get with the June 2012, is there a cheaper wholesale rate? And so that this will be the time to do it when everything gets done versus a price of when we do one at a time.
Yeah, who pays?
I think I know what you're asking.
I mean, like, is this our window of opportunity that, because I think that the community believes this is the window of opportunity, that if we're going to make changes, at least the calls that I'm getting, that everybody's starting to lobby for their new names. And so there's the assumption that now's the time to do it, and I'm just wondering if we get a cheaper rate when we buy in bulk.
Yes. Since we are going to change out a lot of the station signage, that would already be a part of the contract that we're doing, correct. But again, going back to the station-specific signs, if we were not planning to do that, the jurisdictions would bear the cost of anything that we were not planning to do otherwise.
So if we could get...
But there should be a value add there for you in the bigger contract.
But if we could get a menu of costs, if they're differential based on whether you're changing out the station versus the pylons versus, you know, whatever the menu cost is, because the map only needs to really be done once. So there's that. And then the second is, and maybe we already have this, Mr. Chair, the deadline by which we need to have whatever the process is, 120 days or otherwise, so that there's a common community understanding of what we're doing.
Well, this isn't a one-time thing because of the way the Dulles service is coming online. It will be coming online in three pieces. So we have the first piece, which is we're getting ready for Dulles, which is the blue-yellow realignment, which is next June. So anything that we want incorporated in that, we really need to know now the research is really kind of done in these focus groups. We got feedback on all the proposed names.
Well, lastly, Mr. Chair, along those lines, that it still would seem that if you're going to be changing the maps and the things that will incur costs to Metro, that there would be windows of opportunity.
Yes.
That if you're going to make changes. So if we knew what those three times were and came to an agreement of when we would have to have the recommendations in, that there be some discounted rate for participating within the windows of opportunity.
Well, Mr. Tarroff, Barbara, I think you can answer the first one in terms of the...
Yeah, if you go to the next slide.
Yeah.
Next. Forward. There we go. We need to know if you want to be on the first round, because we will bring back the first round in October for the board to approve. But I will say we've already done the consumer research piece of anything that was out there. So that should be of help.
Well, I doubt that would prevent the board from, you know, doing something different regardless of, you know, with the consumer. I'm sure the board will have some stamp on this, right?
Well, if the schedule is for board action on station name change, for the 2012 map, that's the deadline.
Yes.
Right.
The cost implications of the request are not clear, as you pointed out, in terms of allocating cost if a jurisdiction wants to change a name as part of the 2012 map. Are there specific jurisdiction charges, or is that a system cost? Needs to be clarified.
The other thing that needs to be clarified, I think, and then I'm really done, is what latitude does the staff have to determine the name? And what are we agreeing upon the board's latitude to decide finally the name?
I think it's a board action. It's clear board action on station names.
Got it.
For 2012, this is not a staff.
And the board, yeah, the board, it's a management policy, but the board approves station names.
Okay.
We will come and tell you whether, what the results of the research are on a particular suggestion and whether it's consistent with the policy or not consistent with the policy. Then the board does what it wants.
But I also think it needs to be clarified that if we're agreeing to a primary name, mm-hmm. a jurisdiction needs to take responsibility for listing their preference for primary name and secondary name. If we're changing this framework, which I think is a rational way to look at this, then a jurisdiction has a responsibility for listing its preference about primary versus secondary, not just a long thing and then the board gets to pick or tries to sort out what is the primary name in this. So I think there is an assumed responsibility at the jurisdiction level to list primary and secondary preferences. I'm sorry, Mr. Downey.
Yeah, I think we need to back up and always state that the principle here is that we're doing what makes sense for the customer. Right. Mm-hmm. Customer orientation, customer wayfinding. I think the proposals here go a long way towards doing that, but we simply shouldn't put ourselves in a position because we're going to have a new map. Names are were open to change. I think they still need to be addressed in terms of do they serve the customer?
Mm-hmm. I want to backtrack just a little because the line that runs mostly through Arlington will not have much of an effect on these names. The Arlington, the orange and blue lines are not going to have a lot of change. So I just want to verify this: the cost that the system is assuming here is the cost of going from these, of now implementing potentially a primary secondary name system. That's the system's cost or the jurisdictional cost as this is being read?
No, that's the system.
That's the system cost. Okay, good. But let me just ask my, right, because the system's changing the map. But I just want to, so the incremental cost that Tommy is talking about has to do with whether a jurisdiction wants to add something to a station name that already exists or make an adjustment to the name, recommend an adjustment to the name which has not come through the vetting process. Do I have that right? Trying to figure out what I'm paying for versus what other people are paying for.
What we would propose is if we were going to be changing it anyway, then it's the system as part of the whole Dulles extension project,
well,
right?
If you're changing the map.
If you're changing the map at all.
So we're going to do that anyway.
Yes.
We're doing that anyway.
We're doing that anyhow, so we're going to reprint, put them all in place. So that, whether you add a name here or donate a name, it's no difference in the cost on the map itself.
Right.
We're doing it. However, as was pointed out earlier, if you're and Barbara will correct me if I'm wrong, if you're changing the name of a station, an existing station, and you add, XYZ to it, then the cost of every sign in that station that has to be changed, the pylons that have to be changed in that station have to be absorbed, I would think, by the jurisdiction. That's up to the board. That's the different, that's the differentiation.
But the move to primary, secondary, and how that might affect the pylons is the system.
We would do that as part of the overall thing.
Right. And,
but the jurisdictions are paying for if they want to
change a whole new
change
station.
Change a whole, or add a new secondary.
Yeah, and on the first round, it was my recommendation that we go with what the customer had indicated on these first primary, secondaries. That is my recommendation.
So.
Could I also say that while you referenced it, there is not a clear framework for putting some of these requests into the context of the neighborhood map at the stations. A lot of the neighborhood maps have not been changed for years and years and years. And stuff like the Chicago School of Psychology, at McPherson Square, which there's something appropriate in a weird way about that. But putting that on the neighborhood map, the neighborhood maps at the stations over time have been pushed back because some of the most visible spaces were valuable for advertising. So station maps got pushed to the back of the station platform itself. Most of the station maps that used to be present at the mezzanine level are gone. There is no mezzanine level visibility in a lot of stations about the neighborhood maps. The neighborhood maps probably should be at the mezzanine level as well as at the platform level to be able to catch the wayfinding needs of riders. And I think the whole neighborhood map has been neglected as a part of meeting some of these felt needs about Georgetown University Law School, Judiciary Square. It belongs on a neighborhood map. The neighborhood map needs to be more visible, and people should be able to regularly request upgrades to the neighborhood map if they think that they have something that needs to be highlighted there. That's a legitimate need that we're not meeting through the neighborhood map process. And I would ask that you take a harder look through customer surveys, et cetera, about what they think they need about neighborhood map.
Okay.
Yeah. And location.
That'd be great.
Even a cycle to just of like every 2 years, there's a time you could come in and say, we've built five more things and we need to adjust that neighborhood map, or the hotel is gone and it's.
No, that's a good idea. They were refreshed last year, but I think it's a good idea to put them in front of customers and ask them, what do you think ought to be on this? So I think that's a good idea.
And where they're at within the station environment.
The visibility.
Because they don't, in a lot of cases, they don't serve a very good wayfinding process. I'm sorry. Ms. Porter.
I hate to beat this thing to death, but I have to say I'm still sort of confused about the issue that Mr. Wells brought up. Right now, as I understand it, if a jurisdiction requests a name change, there's a set price, essentially, that's supposed to pay for the changes in the system. Am I right about that?
No, there's not a set price. What happens is, and I'm glad you asked that question, but what happens is there's a process by which we literally price it out. In other words, we go through and figure out how much it costs. So we go through and say, okay, well, the platform signs need to be changed. The pylons need to be changed at this station, but also all the way down the line. Mm-hmm. So we literally go through and provide a cost estimate for the change.
Okay. I appreciate that clarification. But then the next question is, so if a jurisdiction were planning to request a change that's consistent with this overall change in the map, then what you would price for them would be just the changes in that individual station, because the other things would be included in the overall change in the map.
Right. Anything that we weren't planning to do otherwise would be in there. But because we're doing such a big swoop of changes, a lot would be already accounted for. But you're right, we would figure out what was not in there, and that would be how much it is.
Okay. Right. And what, in the last question, what is the process and the timeline for doing that? For example, if a jurisdiction comes with a proposal, the board accepts it, at what point is the cost estimate made?
Before we ask for the board's action, I'd want you to understand what the cost was that somebody else, and they should understand what the cost is.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Wells?
And will you be making recommendations of changing current names, not just adding names. But for example, the U Street, Cardoza, et cetera. So you're not, even though that the focus group said those ought to be changed from primary to secondary or that they're too long, you're not making recommendations to change existing names.
I'm not, thank you. I'm not suggesting that we change the existing names, but what I am suggesting is that we take our cue from our customers and we say U Street, which gets to be in a bigger font, and the other name is right below, the African American Civil War Memorial is, and Cardozo is right below. That's all I'm suggesting. I'm not suggesting that we change.
No, I agree with that, but does that entail then the change to the other things that are not necessarily the map?
We would not change out, it's my recommendation that we haven't totally looked at it, we needed to first get approval on this concept, but that we wouldn't change out all the signs unless we were doing that, and as part of the sign design, that we would actually look at how would this concept look on a platform sign, how would it play out on a pylon.
Well, in terms of timing, if we go with the 120 day with adopting board adoption in October, then the community process would need to start this month, would need to start in July.
For name change.
Right. Which may be different from primary and secondary, right. Where you keep the name, but you reorganize it.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
But for name change, and the degree to which name change, like if we add a curly W to Navy Yard, I assume that's a name change. So that process would need to start this month.
But right. We did research on that because we researched all of the...
Right, yeah. But in terms of this policy that we're looking at adopting, whether you did research on it or not, that the community process begins this month for us to adopt by October. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And what establishes... community process, like what qualifies to meet the policy?
Well, community process is one thing, consumer research is another. And so what I'm suggesting is we actually do customer research on proposed names. So the jurisdiction would come forth and say, we have three or four names that we'd like to test, or we have this one that we want to test. And we would put it before customers to ask for a reaction, because the communities have connections
I agree. And for technical purposes, Mr. Chair, and you're right, it doesn't say community process, it says customer input process. So for technical purposes, for the expectations of our customers, we have to have some understanding of what that means so that we're meeting policy should we adopt it?
Research. Research usually can take a number of forms.
There. You're talking about customer research as
yes.
opposed to customer input in the context which we
I can specify about. If you would prefer
right.
that we say research. I could make that clear.
Right. Otherwise, at least in the district, we'd expect we'd be going out to advisory neighborhood commissions and
right.
and all of that. If it's depending on what the process is, so we'll need some clarification so that expectations are clear.
I'll specify
to
research.
Our customers.
Well, in the past we've had neither. We just did it without either customers or without neighborhood input. I think this is a step forward about involving the customer first, because this is a wayfinding process. And the second is to have a neighborhood involvement process about the station naming within their neighborhood.
Well, then understanding the difference between customer input process versus neighborhood involvement and what the expectations are to the community on neighborhood involvement, what the window of timeline is. Is it 120 days before the board makes a decision? There are a number of groups, now that we have bids especially, the bids have true expectations and stakeholder ownership in what our decisions are. And so our clarifications to them of what their windows of opportunity to lobby you and to try to convince you of the wisdom of their change will be important.
Can I ask, add just something on that? I think the community involvement is something that the jurisdiction controls and can set that up as a shorter, longer time frame. For us, we would like to see, probably in parallel, but if you want to do it sequentially, you could, is the customer research that goes with it. So we would work with the jurisdiction to set up the customer research part, and that's what we say we could do within 120 days. The community involvement would be whatever the particular jurisdiction wants to do and how they want to do it, and whatever time frame they want. The key thing for us in the instant case is that in October, the board should make a decision so that people can take advantage of the discount, if you will, for a name change. And then there'll be another opportunity, I don't know the exact date, when we do the next map change for phase one of Dulles, where again, there would be an opportunity for the discount.
I think the jurisdictions have their own responsibilities about their community involvement process. I think the authority has a responsibility about the customer input side. And each of these has a different window of opportunity to get a large-scale change affected that includes specific neighborhood changes. And the first one comes
specific
on
changes
the,
that meet our policy, not right. Simply we'll do it because we're doing the map anyway.
And I'd expect our federal partners will want a clear process role, which is going to be different from neighborhood input and possibly even be somewhat different from customer input in terms of the federal interest, whether it be National Park Service or others, that will have an interest in our choices. So I just extended the process by 20 years.
But it also includes an involvement process around the neighborhood maps, which I think are critical wayfinding pieces of help that are at the neighborhood level. Mr. Jane Cole.
A couple things. First, I want to go on record as saying that I do not want the Tacoma Station changed name at all. I like the name Tacoma, and we should keep it that. So, second thing relates to, I presume when you talk about the system changes, you already have some sort of money aside in the capital budget to make these changes. Has this already been earmarked as money in our capital program? But I can assume right now that you haven't actually procured a contractor to do this service, to make signs and such. Is that correct? Okay. I'm just laying a foundation here for the question of, depending on your procurement strategy, you could have a long-term contract proposal, which you could have work order items for certain types of name changes, which could be set in advance when you award the contract. And I'm just throwing that out as an option to consider in the future.
Could I? We have three more items on the agenda here. For this one is the rail car design review, one is the vital signs report, and the third is the review of the secretary's letter. And I would only ask that we get a clarification that you were asking for a board action here about an official board policy around primary and secondary names?
It's not a resolution as such, and the policy is really a management policy around station names.
But
and
you're asking for a modification of the board guidelines?
No. I think it would be helpful, though, is if we had some sort of endorsement that this is the direction that
you're
we want to go.
You're asking for a board policy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we don't. Okay. Okay. Yes.
Could you make a recommendation?
I'd like to recommend that the board adopt a policy to move to transition to a primary secondary name approach. Is that good?
So. And reaffirm the management policy.
Yes, and reaffirm management policy.
Good. I hear a motion. Second. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In moving towards the primary-secondary approach, will that have a financial cost on the things that are not map-related in using a primary-secondary approach, signage at the stops?
No. The way, what we intend to do is apply this to the map and not change the pylons at this point, not spend that money until such time as we have to change the pylons, then we would introduce it. For other reasons.
Is that clear?
Nope. Oh, let me restate it. I'm sorry. On the map, we're going to change the primary and secondary under this policy because we have to change the maps now, and we're going to adopt it. With the pylons, with the actual names up there, that identifies the station when you arrive, our intention is not to change that now because there's no reason to change the pylon names, primary, secondary, at this point. If we're going to change the pylon, the strip, then we would introduce it. Where we introduce that? It's only when we do a system change that we actually make the change. We're not looking for incremental costs to go out and do this now.
So for clarification, Mr. Chair, my understanding this is a cost-neutral policy that we're adopting at this time to all jurisdictions.
Yes, it's no longer – yes, there's no incremental cost over what's in the budget for the route changes.
And if this is a board action, I assume it will come to the board meeting with some explanatory material.
All those, any other comments? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Thank you. Does that complete all of the discussion that you've intended on this issue?
and more.
And more than you asked for.
But helpful.
The next item is the information item on the car, 7,000 tiers.
Yes, I think that'd be good. Yeah, let's go.
Okay, onward. More customer input. Next page. Dave and I were last before the board on the customer input process on the 7,000 series cars in November. And so we are here to update you on all the multiple customer groups that we have involved in the design and also to provide you with an update on the design. Next slide. The process really began in 2006, and there were multiple groups of customers and advisory groups that were included and talked to about the design. Some of you may remember that we had displays at National Airport. We had sessions with the RAC and the advisory accessibility group at the Yards, Greenbelt, and Branch Avenue. We looked at passenger flows, got feedback from the police department, also our own maintenance, car maintenance employees and operations departments. And all of that went into the original spec, the scope of work that was developed for the cars. Next slide. The piece that we discussed and that we talked about, it really involved the greater customer input on the interior design for the cars. And while you had the general idea of how the cars were, the specification and the scope of work for the cars, the inside and the interiors really are the place where we have an opportunity to make the cars especially distinctive to our customer base. And to assist us in doing that, we brought in, and I'd like to introduce to you, Masamichi Utagawa, He and his firm, Antenna Design, were brought in to help us do concept designing and take us to through the preliminary and concept design stages. He has extensive transportation, transit experience, specifically worked most recently in the New York City Transit Authority's R-142 and R-143 cars. He also has ticket vending machine experience. We should keep that in mind for future years. And important to us, he has worked previously with our manufacturer, Kawasaki. So it already had a working relationship with them for past projects, so that was useful to us. But the idea there is that we are taking, and we took a typical industrial design approach, meaning that you create concepts, you test them, you research them, you refine them, you continue to refine them, you continue to test and validate all the way down to the point at which you go onto the line to manufacture whatever it is that you're designing. And in that regard, we have taken concept designs that Masamichi has developed, and we've worked through employees working groups. We've talked and included train operators, car maintenance staff. We have focus group work, which I will cover today. We've also consulted with the Writers Advisory Council, the Accessibility Advisory Council, jurisdiction staff. We've also reached out to safety and security. The police and the Tri-State Oversight Committee representatives have also been consulted in this process. And I'm going to turn it over to Dave, who's going to discuss the employee input that we got.
One of the major focuses, naturally, was for the train operator. What we're looking at is a pretty close to a total redesign as much as possible for the ergonomics inside of the cab, along with the crash worthiness. The other approach on this was understanding that we're in an environment where we're 2.5 to 3 minute headways. What can we do to maximize that operator's response time if we have an emergency and or some type of equipment failure? It got down to the level of where you place switches, where you place bypass switches, push buttons, everything else. Also, from an ergonomic standpoint, we have some areas where operators literally have to get down on their knees or look over and bend over seats, and you have all these other trains moving throughout the system. So through the utilization of technology, aviation, different, you know, rail systems, that's where we're really focused it at as well. Since we will see manual operations here as well as automatic train operation, also different placement of the master controller, which will be huge. It's kind of a very awkward position, you know, at this stage. So we want to take advantage of that at this point in time. If we could go to the next slide.
Dave, could I just ask a question on that? Inside the cab, you're going to have operators who run a 7,000 car series one day and a different car another day. Will certain things be located where they know where they'll be?
Yes, I mean, primarily, for example, like some buttons and, you know, emergency response items. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So but look around and say, where
yeah.
is it?
But over the years, if we could clarify, there has been some changes, you know, throughout each design, each different manufacturer. And this going into this right in here, we're really focused on the operators to say, where does it make sense to have this equipment at? Because realistically, at the end of the day, the more comfortable that they feel inside that cab, the better that they will perform. And that's what the main focus is. Okay, on maintainability, this is also something that's a little bit different. The maintenance staff was also involved in this process, you know, beyond the day one experience. They were also part of the selection review of all of these contractors and vendors that we were working on. It's very, very important to stress that we are also looking to try to create a safer environment for our employees to maintain this equipment. One of the things that's always been is how do you integrate it? Where do you put it at? Okay, we got it mounted on there and we move on. But there is a big, big concern on our part as we put this thing together to make sure that, you know, we don't, you know, put people in harm's way. The other thing is that we looked at this car on a 40-plus year cycle, so whenever we go into midlife, it modular in its application, what equipment is bolted there to reduce costs, which was a big, big focus on that. Also, from a standpoint of some of the technology that they're going to be seeing and introduced on it, what can they really focus on to accelerate replacement and/or run it in a safe environment as possible? And that, okay, on the safety side, this in itself was a large input as well. Safety department, the transit police. Open under the seat, no equipment lockers. So just to kind of re-stress that, you know, right now we're dealing with a vehicle that's got the access areas up underneath the seats. This rail car, when you look at the future renderings and stuff, there's nothing underneath the seat. That means there's a 100% sweep, there's accessibility, it's easier to clean, but it's also a safer vehicle, you know, across the board because you don't have that limitations and stuff that's there. These rail cars also coming on board will have security cameras. Right now, we just have from a monitoring standpoint if we do a special test or whatever, but factory install, day one, these cars will have security cameras inside, which will be very helpful. To clarify on a forward-facing camera, I've done this another authority I worked at. It was very helpful. A lot of times, everybody focuses on the inside of the car and what's taking place, but there's a lot of activity and stuff that happens outside. So we want to be able to film out of the front end of the vehicle, pulling into a station, instant review, a lot of things, you know, that could be applied in this area right in here. It gets down even to the level where you put the camera at to make sure maybe the windshield wiper is keeping the glass clean so that way you get better visibility. But that level of detail is very important for us moving forward. And again, naturally, we'll talk a little bit more about the displays and stuff whenever we get into the interior because there's some functionality there that we think is going to be very positive.
To gather the customer insight and preferences and get reaction, we conducted a series of 6 focus groups. They were actually conducted on site at the New Carrollton Maintenance Facility where we have the soft mock-up, and that is the model, a half-size model of a car. And we had, again, a range of people who are frequent riders, moderate riders, infrequent riders. We also had an opportunity to walk through the Riders Advisory Council and the Accessibility Advisory Group through that mock-up. We were looking for reaction to design concepts, which we created a series of 5 different concepts. Masamichi worked with us to create 5 different concepts that we tested. So they were looking at the interior and getting reaction to those concepts. We looked at the bonnet or the front end of the cars to get a reaction about what people thought about those. And then we literally walked them through the model, the half-size soft mock-up model, which is of plywood, which I will show you a picture of in a moment. Next slide. All of the research really starts from a marketing position, and you can't expect customers to react to something unless you give them a context for it. And in that in the positioning, what the direction was that we want to achieve, and the statement that we want to achieve first and foremost is that the cars are safe, that customers feel reassured in the environment that they are safe and secure. Secondly, that they are comfortable, meaning that they feel welcomed, that this is their environment, and that it becomes a calming place for them to almost escape out of the hustle and bustle that goes on in our stations. And as they're trying to race to get onto the, you know, and all the morning activity that they or evening activity that they're leaving from, that they're spacious, that they have a sense of room, a personal space, that they feel that their environment is larger than what they might expect, that they are inviting. This is, I think, especially important for marketing purposes and going forward, that they are inviting in a way that they pull people in to consider us that maybe have not recently. So that this new equipment signals out that people should reconsider coming on board if they haven't been with us in a while. They're customer-focused, down to the smallest details that we were thinking about our customers when we put these designs together, and that it is evident. That they are accessible, meaning that all customers feel like they belong here and that they are their cars. That we project a contemporary, modern, you know, leading edge, that we are really setting the pace for the rest of the country, that this is the nation's capital, and actually for the world to look at what we have to offer on these cars, and that they are uplifting, meaning that they generate a sense of excitement. And if you think about it, the imagery, we have these iconic stations with these, you know, major ceilings and the coffer tiles, and they are their statement, people know them, but they're standing at the platform, and what we want to do is to create a sense of anticipation, and that when they enter the station, it uplifts the space, and it becomes just an overall uplifting experience. Next slide. Overall, the customers reacted very positively to the concepts. Comments were that they were clean and open, and they look comfortable. It looks futuristic. Quote, way more inviting. It shows that despite issues that Metro may be having or facing, that they take a sense of pride in what they're offering customers. Very high marks on very informative. It has lots of maps, and I like that, was one comment. There were a couple of areas that we were working on, and you'll see how we have moved forward on refining that. A little bit too sparse, maybe a little too utilitarian looking. So we have worked on the design process to warm up the cars, frankly, to make them look a little bit more comfortable and inviting. And also, we had quite a bit of discussion around handhold bars, so we'll talk about that. This is there were five concepts, as I mentioned. The two in this round is what we want to show you very briefly, and then we have evolved even beyond those two. But with that, I want to turn it over to Masamichi, who's going to describe these two concepts.
Thank you, Barbara. Hi, my name is Masamichi Udagawa. I'm an industrial designer. Having practiced for some 22 years, and specifically in the rail, in experience of over 12 years, so I'm fairly well qualified, I guess. But anyway, I'd like to discuss just briefly two design concepts that scored well in our first customer research or focus group. The first theme, let's say the design has physical aspect as well as psychological aspect. And also design has functional aspect as well as aspect of identity. And with functional aspect, as Barbara mentioned, we have to address safety, comfort, maintainability, operational efficiency. With aspect of identity, we have to come up with something people will like, something people can emotionally associate with. And then taking the cue from keywords that Barbara and the team established, we came up with five design themes. And these are two of the five themes that, again, scored favorably. The first one is we call the business elegance. It's overall kind of cool design theme. The blue is sort of signature color. And we, as a counterpoint, we had the brown scheme, sort of updated the Umata signature color. As you see, the stations, signage, identity, they use brown extensively. So we thought first, why don't we try to update the brown? But people really didn't like seeing the brown again. The color is a very subjective thing, and it's very, very context sensitive. So in the context of a DC system, people are a bit tired and maybe bored with brown, and they don't associate that color with the new vehicle. So the blue was well received, Next theme, that's just a screenshot of color palette. We have the dark floor and the very light wall and ceiling. That creates psychological effect of making space appear larger than physically is, addressing psychological aspect of the design. The seat color is represented on the upper left corner. It's a textured blue seat covering. Next theme, we call it subtle signature. Well, the difference is really subtle with this projection screen, but there are differences. The subtle signature is based on the bluish gray, and because we thought blue, not in the context of DC, but in the context of rail industry, the blue is sort of like default color, especially in the last 10 years or so. So we wanted to have something a bit more sophisticated than just a standard blue. So we tried that, and this fared very favorably. Color scheme, we have, again, the dark floor and the light wall and ceiling with different color spectrums. And the upper left corner, you see the slightly different covering.
Just some comments on those concepts. If you could go back to the business elegance mock-up scene there. As Masamichi mentioned, they like these color schemes particularly a lot. Both of the color schemes were found to be cool and calming, and they really thought that they were on, you know, spot on. They liked the fact that we had multiple points for holding on. On the seat backs, they like the horizontal bar across the back of the seat, as you can see it, because it allows them to pull up or hang on. But I tell you, they did not like the headrest cover that we had there, because it will get dirty. I don't want to touch it. Also, with respect to the seats, they prefer vinyl. They don't want cloth seats on the trains, again, for cleanliness reasons. And they're also very mindful. It was interesting that they were respectful of our having to maintain them and watched out for us, that Metro would have to spend a lot on having to clean all of that up. On the flooring, they like the resilient flooring. What they liked about is also the color. That we showed them, the speckled colors, that it brings it to life, the car to life to them. In particular, there, in a couple of forward ones, there was red, kind of a red, white, and blue. They thought that was really fitting of the nation's capital. And the privacy screens that you see there, those are the screens on the other side of the priority seating arrangement there. They like those for a couple of reasons. One is personal space. It gives a little blockage from when the train is crowded and you have people crowding in, and it just helps. They also, and you'll see in a moment, we've worked on adjusting the height, right, so the backpacks aren't hanging over onto somebody's head. That was, you know, kind of comments, that those sort of comments that we received. We could go forward. There's the color scheme on this. On the seats, as you can see in the seats, there is a V in the seat back. This is an interesting reaction that we got, is that they like the fact that there's a delineation between the two seats, that it signals personal space. They like that it's open in the event that they're traveling alone and they have a bag or a child, and that they can, you know, move around. But this is your space, and this is my space. And they think that that's a nice design feature, also setting it off. Let me see if there's anything that I mentioned, and we'll get to the signage in a minute, if we could keep going. So there's that red, white, and blue floor speckling, and they're not, also I should mention that the getting rid of the carpet on the floor was positively received. Let me just say that. Go forward. So this was the mock-up that we walked customers through, and this is used for to demonstrate placement of items, spatial purposes, to give a sense about where the seats are, to give a sense about where the signage is, the handholds, and so on. So next one. It was very helpful. As you can see, you go all the way inside. We had seats there. We literally put up the privacy screens. We put up maps. We made it, you know, as best that we can to give them an idea. It was the exact width and so on, although half of the length, to give them an idea of what it would be like. Next, please. The information displays. The one on the right, of course, you saw that in a recent presentation on station names, but there are two of the horizontal signs to the right that are being placed on the cars, and there are four of the video monitors on the left, and Dave made mention of this safety aspect of this as well. Both of them show you where you are in your trip, point in time, light up the next destination. On the left, it also is an opportunity for us to highlight landmarks, areas of interest that we might also put on those neighborhood maps, shows where connecting services are. In this instance, I think we have Mark up there in Amtrak. So, and in the box to the right where the train car is, you can divide it and actually show a video. So we could have a safety video running as well. So these information displays were overwhelmingly popular, and one of the first things that most people mentioned was how much information there was and how positive and good that was, since, you know, it was so very useful and helpful to them. Next slide. Handhold bars. This is more, we received a couple of reactions, and I wanted to comment on what we did about that. In the center door, customers were looking for a place to hang on, primarily those of my height, and it was a place to secure themselves. So we did test the center pole. The accessibility group was especially helpful for us because they brought their wheelchairs on and we were able to check. But for maneuverability purposes and safety evacuation, to give a full-length clearance for that car, we had to remove the center pole. However, to replace the center pole, we put up more poles and more handholds around the perimeter of the door. We've done that. Additionally, unlike any of the other cars, we now have a vertical pole at every single seat, which replaces the spring-loaded handles. Our female customers indicated that they felt uncomfortable grabbing up, that they felt, you know, they had their bags, and certainly I can attest to this. You're trying to keep it all together. You don't know who the person is that's right below you. So every single seat now has a vertical pole. We have horizontal poles for people Dave's size, and we're investigating even more in that area. And overall, for people my height, we have how much more handholds?
What we did here is we, you know, the 5 and the 6 was the next generation. We identified, we call it a vertical grab point, and it's where, you know, several people could grab and latch onto it. On average, we're looking at about 26 locations inside the rail car with that amenity. With the 7K, we added another 16 points throughout the rail car, you know, around the doorways, around seats and everything else where that space and stuff wasn't, you know, taken out. And in the presentation, as you can see, there was also just a, you know, linear feet wall is important, but it was basically to focus on the vertical points where you could grab onto, around the doorways especially.
Mr. Giancola has a perspective.
Yeah, as someone who is not tall challenged, I like the idea of the poles and can comment that many of the current metal as well as leather straps aren't being used because they're just not in the right place, for one, and they're just not convenient. The biggest problem is always around the doors where people tend to want to crowd and you can't get them to distribute out. And I think the fact that you've gotten a lot of vertical poles in there will help significantly. So I'm very happy with that. I did want to ask a question. You may be covering this a little later, though. was there any comment from the focus groups or anyone regarding the width of the seats, or was that even an option that was laid out to them as to consider? In other words, you know, we are getting a little broader in the beam, in a sense, in our nation. So, you know, sometimes you see somebody sitting in a seat that they're in a seat and a half.
Maybe it was a modest group, but they didn't ask about if it was. But they are the same width as our current seats. So we are going to continue to test the seats, because what we had in there was a mock-up of a seat. It wasn't a prototype. So what we want to do is take this step further when we get the prototype of the actual seat and have people sit in it and tell us what they think about it. I think that's important. So I think we, you know, we can move on from this, point.
In relation to the hand holds and the bars, with your accessibility group, did you also, those that are blind or also, you know, having the bars that come out too high up sometimes may be a, you know, a barrier if you can't see them. Did we test it out with other handicapping conditions?
We did. We had, we did. There were concern. There were, the chair of the accessibility committee, Patrick Sheehan, was there, and I walked him through the car. We had other concerns. They expressed other concerns, which we're accommodating later, about highlighting the priority seating area, and which you'll see in our final design how we've done that, because they find that even though it's marked, people sit in it. So we've also started increasing the station announcements and the
store announcements. But in terms of the bars, that was looked at?
Yes, they tested all those. I walked them all the way, yeah. And okay. They were different.
So the bars are not floating out over the, in the walk area?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next slide.
Sorry. This issue is actually really important to people in Arlington, how many places there are to hold on, because our rush hour experience is, well, the cars might be bright and airy and all of those things, that is not what we're seeing. What we're seeing is people standing and we're smushing on in lots of cases. So, and I really appreciate, I know that you all, I've brought this up before and you've looked at it. Here's my question. We have a series of ways that people behave now on trains when they're really crowded. One of them is where you have those panels that stick out. Mm-hmm. The one person puts their back up against it, and then it removes the possibility of anybody else holding on to it very carefully, And I noticed, you know, we've added bars around the maps here. But again, what happens if you watch people is the first person on puts their back up against that, and nobody else can hold on. As we bring these in, is there any way, at least initially, to indicate that people could stand themselves differently to allow more people to hold, that we have an expectation of that in order to shift some of this behavior? Because it really does make it hard for the short person who's the last one on to find anything to hold on. And it is because we've had this pattern of, you know, grab the comfortable space for you, and everybody else kind of has to, some kids said it's like surfboarding. They call it metro surfing because you have nothing to hold on to.
Well, I think the best option for that is to give people an option. And we've tried to put the bars in many places, and actually there's even one more vertical bar that we haven't had previously, which is right on the other side of the priority seating. It's like braces the priority seating. So I see somebody walking around, whoever is perched against that privacy screen, because that would be a really close place. We would have that. So that.
Barbara, I hate to cut you short. The
administrator's here.
The administrator is here.
Well, that's for good reason, I think. And
I will pass the gavel to the chair to convene this part of the committee meeting.
Good morning, Mr. Rogoff. Thank you for joining us today. And for board members, we were given the opportunity at the request from the Secretary of Transportation's office and Mr. Rogoff providing some input into the Dulles Metro Rail Phase 2 project. And just for an update for the public as well as the board members, Metro has been participating in the opportunity given by the Secretary of Transportation to try and work with the jurisdictions and the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority on the financing and overall project movement on the Phase 2. And we have had, I guess, four meetings. Is that called five? How well we forget. Five meetings. And out of the last meeting, we were given a proposal to take back to each of our boards to get feedback. And so Mr. Rogoff has offered to come and answer any questions, and we appreciate him being here. And Mr. Sarles is going to open this up and give us the status of where we are and what the proposal says.
Okay, as the chair mentioned, there's been ongoing discussions with regard to Dulles. The whole point of the discussions is that under the locally preferred alternative, the alignment that was chosen some time ago, the current estimate is around $3.8 billion. And there's been well-covered discussion of how to reduce that cost to bring it down towards $2.5 billion. Just as a quick overview, this is the Dulles extension. There's two phases to it. First phase is under construction out to Willie Avenue. And then the second phase, which we'll be talking about today, is the part out to the airport itself. As I said, next slide, there have been discussions led by the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, to try to bring everyone together to come up with a plan that can go forward. As I mentioned earlier, it was $3.8 billion is the current estimate. We've gone through as a group led by Peter, looking at particular options that could reduce the cost down towards $2.5 billion. On this first chart here is the Secretary's proposal that he issued, which showed a number of changes to the original project, if you will. The first one, and I'll show a slide subsequently to give you an idea of the spatial layout of this, is to construct an aerial Dulles Airport station near the North Garage rather than the tunnel that was in the original alignment. Doing that, there were some additional station amenities that would be added to the station itself, a modest station that would cost $10 million. But that's the big nugget there, is over half a billion dollars in reduction in the project budget. There were other things that were looked at that would affect the project budget. The transfer of the Route 28 station to Fairfax County is their responsibility to have that constructed and pay for it. The transfer of parking facilities to Fairfax and Loudoun County, which would, again, reduce the project budget itself. As you can see, one's about $136 million, the other's $235 million. And then what impacts WMATA specifically is there were several recommendations to modify the design. Which I have agreed to. None of them impact the maintainability of the station, and in fact, some are consistent with what was done in Phase 1 already, the part that's under construction. That included reducing the length of the canopies from, it was the full 8-car train length to about 6 cars, I think, right? 4 cars, I'm sorry. 4 cars. That was already agreed to in Phase 1. With regard to some bridge structures using steel in lieu of concrete, and with regard to station finishes, modifying them, reducing them to be more in line with what we have used already at the Largo station in previous construction. So that is the current proposal by the Secretary to all the stakeholders in terms of bringing the cost estimate down to around $2.7 billion. There are other things on the table that have not yet been addressed because of timing of information, if we can go to that, that could hold potential future savings. Value engineering, which would be done by MWA, the donation of property to the project in lieu of right-of-way purchase, that's by others, doesn't involve us. Two that do involve us is number 11 and number 13. One is reducing the number of traction power substations by two, and the other is to reduce the number of rail cars, basically by one train set, as I recall. In both cases, our initial reaction to those was that we felt that it would impact our customer service, but we are willing and are starting to do a simulation on the traction power substations to have, you know, through a computer simulation, prove out whether or not there's impacts that we could see in terms of our service. And I want to be very specific on that. It's not so much about having the number of traction power substations supporting the regular day-to-day service, but rather when you have a stoppage for whatever reason and how fast you recover from that stoppage. That's our concern, and that's what we'll prove out through the simulation. Second has to do with the number of rail cars. We had done an operations plan when this project was put through the environmental process. We updated that a few years ago. We are almost complete with our latest update of the rail fleet plan. We should be getting that this month, and we will then review it with the FTA, and that, in my view, will help us determine whether, in fact, there is the opportunity to reduce the cars without impacting our customer service. So those are two of the things that still have to be looked at, and we intend to look at it over the this month and the next month and discuss it further with the FTA and the other stakeholders. One other slide, just to bring everybody up to date, probably already seen this someplace, somewhere. But here's the terminal. Here's the proposed underground station, about 550 feet from and the moving sidewalk supplies about 110 feet of that. The proposed aerial station is a little further away. It's 1,150 feet, as you can see, with about 450 feet of moving sidewalk. And that's just in front of the parking garage. So in any event, people using the aerial station still have a walk comparable, maybe slightly shorter than people parking in the garage. But clearly the underground station is closer to the terminal. So that is very briefly where we are at this point. Peter, if you'd like to add anything to that, please.
Thank you, Rich, and thank you, Chairman Hudgens, for having us here. Secretary LaHood wanted me to make myself available to all of the pertinent governing boards that are looking at his proposal, and you've taken us up on that opportunity. My principal reason for being here is just to explain in the broadest terms Secretary LaHood's and DOT's motivations in getting involved in this at the project level, and also to answer any questions that you may have regarding the many elements of his proposal. Most importantly, Secretary LaHood involved himself and DOT in this process to ensure that the promised congestion relief from the Dulles Rail Project actually materializes for the residents of Northern Virginia. The FTA initially, as you know, have invested $900 million in federal funds to make phase one of the project to Wheelie Avenue in Reston a reality. When the administration moved forward with that full funding grant agreement, it was done with the understanding that the Airports Authority, in combination with the local jurisdictions, would be financing phase two. What's become clear in recent weeks is that the agreements between the Airports Authority and the jurisdictions has begun to unravel in a way that could be fatal to the project. So the Secretary has become engaged in a arduous process to get the cost of the project as near to the original $2.5 billion cost estimate as would be possible. It was really done with a mind toward ensuring that the congestion relief happened for the people of Northern Virginia, that they get a real transit option all the way out to Loudoun County. But we do it in a fashion that is least costly to county taxpayers and the toll road users. Importantly, the Secretary has come up with a proposal that is based on shared sacrifice by all of the participants in the process. That includes Loudoun and Fairfax County, the Commonwealth of Virginia, WMATA. And I want to emphasize that as we looked at these scope reductions in the project, we were focused on those that did offer significant cost savings, but also maintained a cost-effective approach to the project. They maintained the project performance goals. They were going to sustain expected ridership. And importantly, because time is money in this business, they would minimize the need for very lengthy redesigns and a reevaluation as part of the environmental process that could set the project back another year or 2 years as we completely redesign the project. So there was a constraint to keep the changes in an envelope of things that were achievable and would necessitate delays of perhaps only half a year or more in environmental review. My understanding is that the chairman has supplied you all with a white paper that the FTA produced at the request of the secretary that describes the secretary's final proposal in detail. I'll very quickly go over just a couple of the important elements of it and then take any questions you might have. One element that's gotten a great deal of attention but really is just one overall cost element in the project was doing the aerial station versus the underground station. As you saw in the slide that Rich had put up, the aerial station is farther away from the terminal, but I think it's important to note that as part of the funding adjustments that we are proposing, we would anticipate doing assorted protection for the passengers to insulate them from the weather on the platform. I think it's also important to point out that FTA's experience around the country is that the majority of airport rail station users are not airport passengers, but are largely airport workers or other people commuting to the facility, perhaps to work in the cargo facilities or other elements of the overall airport. You know, airports are throughways for travelers. They're also huge employment centers. And sparing the workers of the Dulles complex the need to pay for parking, we expect a lot of the ridership to come from that universe. As far as the scope reductions that directly impact WMATA, it was critically important to us that WMATA be part of this negotiation. They will be the eventual operator of this system. We have experience around the country where when you have a situation where the project construction agency is different from the operator and there is insufficient communication, the operator takes receipt of a project that's not ideally suited, not ideally cost-effective, not ideally suited to the needs of the passengers, to operations, and that is why we've insisted that WMATA have a seat at the table throughout this process. And I could say I really want to thank Chairman Hudgens, Rich, Dave Kubitschek, Shiva, for all of the cooperation that they've shown through this process. Of the scope reductions that, like I said, directly impact WMATA, reduction in the size of the yard and shops out at the what's identified as the Y-15 area out at Dulles, our contractor initially identified savings potential of upwards of $118 million. Dave Kubitschek and his team came back to us with an estimate that they thought was more accurate of $82 million. What we've really done there is just sharpen our pencils and identify the true cost of the yard that is appropriately attributable to the Silver Line project and how much more yard and shop capability WMATA chooses to build at that facility will be a decision by this board, not by us. The other deltas really are smaller, at least as it relates to the impact on WMATA. I think Rich laid them out. I don't need to go onto them in any greater detail. So I thank you for the opportunity just to present this proposal to you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
Thank you. Mr. McKay.
Let me first start by thanking you for the white paper and the Secretary's involvement in this project. I think it's critical to the region. And frankly, as somebody who comes from Fairfax County, it's nice to have folks involved, what I will call adult supervision that is needed on this project to get the cost in order and the project moving forward in a positive way. So thank you for that. The question that I have in the white paper on page 3 under the financing options, we've talked a lot about things we can take away from the project. We haven't emphasized as much some of the financing options that are out there, and I'm intrigued by one, because there's a new surprising interest by the Commonwealth of Virginia in transit. And at the bottom of page three, there's a comment from the Virginia Transportation Secretary and the Director of VDRPT about some options of increased financing through the Commonwealth of Virginia. And I'm just wondering, do we have any order of magnitude? Were there cost figures discussed with that? And are there any firm commitments to either utilizing the State Infrastructure Bank or any other instrument that the Commonwealth of Virginia may have available to it?
Yes, there is, and I'm glad you've raised it, because this is, if you will, information that has come forward since we distributed this paper on July 3rd. Secretary LaHood has had a number of conversations with Secretary Connaughton in Richmond just in the last couple of days. And we believe we have an understanding that the Commonwealth would put forward at least $150 million out of its State Infrastructure Bank to ease costs of the project and reduce the tolls for the toll road users. In addition, we've had discussions with him regarding the extension of the lease. By extending the lease terms that the Commonwealth has with EMWA, you can stretch out the payment scheme and in so doing have a relatively small but important reduction in the toll rates that will be paid by the toll road users. And that is something that we've been in discussions with him about. Thelma Drake was at our most recent meeting, but we were able to get greater specificity out of Sean Connaughton in the last couple of days.
Okay, and that's a good positive development. One other question, if I might. In the chart of identified cost savings, the transfer responsibility to Fairfax County for the Route 28 station, was there a discussion given as to where that revenue might come from? Did we look at the comprehensive plan in Fairfax County and determine that there were some density increases or other ways that the county might generate that revenue, or is that figure? What went into that figure? Was that the amount of money that MWA quoted would be necessary to build the Route 28 station, and we just pulled that number and assumed that, you know, the county would have some way to generate that revenue?
All of the funding increments that you see on this table are derived from reviews that the PMOC contractor to the FTA has done. These numbers do not entirely line up with the numbers that MWA has put forward. And that's because our project management oversight contractor has taken a fresh and independent look at them. We thought, given the level of, I don't want to say distrust, but suspicion on the part of all of the partners, that FTA could play a valuable role in being sort of an independent arbiter of what the numbers really were. So for the Route 28 station, this is our PMOC's re-estimate of the cost of that station. There were a lot of other proposals on the table, including deferring this station. We had to reject that because to construct this station in a later phase would have involved constructing a center island platform station during ongoing rail operations, which would have doubled the cost and been a logistical nightmare. Mm-hmm. So we have had conversations. You asked about financing. With the jurisdictions about using Secretary LaHood's very scarce TIFIA dollars to help facilitate the transfer of the responsibility of these costs to both Loudoun County and Fairfax County. Importantly, we have found that the TIFIA program plays a very positive role in bringing together public-private partnerships, and I believe both Loudoun and Fairfax are looking at the public-private partnership concept as a way of handling these new responsibilities.
Thank you.
Kind of helicoptering up in a broad view. I mean, obviously, with the nation's capital, we want to have the highest quality transit options at a world-class level. Is the optimal place for the station where the Airports Authority originally proposed?
A lot of that comes down, Mr. Wells, as to who you envision as the principal passengers of the airport station. I think it's important to point out a lot of attention has been given to the airport station, but this is not an airport train. This is a train that's going to serve the entire region through Fairfax and out to Loudoun. Together, you know, the stations at Tysons will serve three times as many passengers as will be served at the airport. Now, what is the optimal location? Well, at one point, consideration was given to actually building the station right underneath the terminal. My understanding is that was rejected when the engineering studies came in terms of what would be necessary for egress and ventilation and how they were going to make that happen under the existing terminal. Certainly for airport passengers, the closer you are to the terminal, the more convenient it is. But as I said before, our experience nationally is that the majority of users of rail transit stations at airports are not airport passengers carrying luggage. They're likely to be airport workers.
Well, I think that, you know, as you've aptly noted, that the district residents will be helping fund this, and that a great interest, obviously, for the taxpayers of the district is to have reliable, good, quality access to an international airport where it's generally more of a one-seat ride than coming out of national. And then, obviously, with the tourist interest for the city and wanting, you know, that this is an international airport and that a lot of our view of what creates a quality transit experience is not necessarily just the workers out at the airport. And so in terms of what is optimal, of what we believe that we'll be sharing an operating cost on, is that this is, you know, it's not the optimal place. It is, it's not the, you know, I really want to commend the Airports Authority for trying to hang in there to get us the best project deliverable possible for the region, which also serves the country. And, you know, I do appreciate there's been a tough fight for them. And I understand that there's economic realities, but I think we're getting a second-class product.
Well, if I could just respond to that briefly. You mentioned the optimal situation being a one-seat ride. The Silver Line to the airport will be a one-seat ride for very, very few riders. One of the things that oversight contractor was able to call out of the data is that the majority of people traveling to the airport will certainly have to change trains at least once, maybe twice. And so they will be hauling luggage if they are a luggage-bearing air passenger from one platform to another, boarding and only getting to the airport having gone through that challenge. You know, obviously we have great economic stress on government at all levels, federal, state, local jurisdictions. Many of you serve on jurisdictional boards and know that better than anybody. I think it's very important that we not let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. What's most important is that we continue to make progress. If we have to put this project aside and bring together the funding partners again 4 or 5 years from now, the project will be twice as complicated and three times the cost. So, you know, difficult decisions had to be made. The Secretary has put forward a proposal based on shared sacrifice. I'm sure that many different players can find it to be suboptimal at different stations and given different constituencies. But I think this is our best shot to keep rail moving out to Fairfax and Loudoun.
I want to thank you and the Secretary for the effort to make that happen, to be sure that we have a project and not no project, which would be a disaster. With respect to the airport service, I think this service, as configured with the aerial, will be competitive with rail access to most airports. I've used a lot of them, and none of them are as convenient as anybody would like them to be, but this one I think will match up to many others. Question on the Commonwealth contribution. If they're providing $150 million from their infrastructure bank, is that expected to be repaid? And if so, from what?
The best answer, obviously, I think that question is best put to Sean Connaughton. I think all of us are looking to structure these transactions in a way that has the maximum impact to lower cost and lower the burden on the toll road payers. The Infrastructure Bank in the Commonwealth is a new creation. They are developing the rules for it as we speak. I would expect Secretary Connaughton working with EMWA to develop a transaction that has the maximum impact, whether that is through a direct grant or through credit assistance, similar to what we provide in TIFIA, I think will be determined downstream.
But looking at the impact of the toll players would certainly be in Secretary Connaughton's interest as well as
absolutely. He is the Secretary for the Commonwealth. I'm a resident of the Commonwealth. I use the toll road, and I hope that's where the focus goes.
I also want to thank you, Peter, for taking the time to come here. It's an important set of issues for the entire region. I just wanted to say that the recommendation about the change in the station location is actually a change in alignment, and as you know better than anybody else, FDA's requirements preclude us from making a decision on that absent the public participation and analysis requirements that any change in an approved alignment requires. So we can't just kind of agree as a matter of board action.
I understand. We anticipate that all of the jurisdictions will honor their public processes that are required. And it is critically important to have the input of the public. And we expect people to go through that. That said, we are obviously in the interest of saving money for everyone, the jurisdictions, the toll payers and everyone else are interested in trying to get to the necessary redesigns and the necessary environmental approvals as quickly as law and regulation will allow.
Thank you. It was useful to this process to have the FTA come in, I think, and become a partner in getting to a conclusion. My question really is about once we go through our process and the board has taken its vote and we've got the new realignment, there are two items, one in the initial set of things and one in the lower set that I have concern about moving forward. And it really is, what role is the FTA planning to play? The parking facilities, the transfer of that to the localities, from the view of an inside the Beltway jurisdiction, those parking facilities are actually very important to make sure that the stuff that runs through my jurisdiction continues to work. Is the Secretary planning to have some involvement to make sure that happens? And similarly, on the value engineering by EMWA, I would assume that some of that might affect WMATA's operations. And again, how does that piece fit moving forward, and what role would you all play in that?
Well, let me say first, as you correctly identified, there are sort of two tiers of recommendations here. And the first are the ones that we really want to chew off now and get agreement on for purposes of getting the cost of the project to below $2.8 billion. Let's remember we were starting north of $3.8 billion. So we think that's an incredibly important statement in terms of getting the cost, the exposure of the toll road payers, the exposure of the jurisdictions to a tolerable level. As it relates to the parking facilities, we fully anticipate that the number of spots will be maintained, though the jurisdictions will have greater flexibility than they've had before in terms of the design of those facilities. Because again, we're trying to put together, they will be trying to put together, with some help from our TIFIA program, public-private partnerships that will involve joint development. So just as was the case in the Wheelie Avenue station under Phase 1, there was some relaxation of the standards, but not a relaxation of the number of parking spots that would be provided for WMATA users, and that helped facilitate the private involvement in that station and in that parking facility. We fully expect to be engaged, and no one will be accepting or assuming any of the second tier of adjustments without consultation. The ones that impact WMATA, as Rich pointed out, are whether or not these additional traction power substations are needed. We are waiting for WMATA's analysis through their simulation contractor to decide whether that's merited or not. If it's workable through a conversation that we have with WMATA, we will want to pursue that. I mean, all of these additional second-tier savings in combination could save an additional $200 million from the project, which is significant. Also, on the matter of rail cars, we have been waiting for WMATA to provide us with a rail fleet car management plan for some time. Rich tells us that we'll be getting it shortly. Really, only through the presentation of that plan can we decide, just as we did at the, with the rail yard, that the appropriate number of rail cars should be something less. The result may be that there is no savings on the rail cars, in which case we won't pursue that option. But again, none of those options are going to be just exercised without consultation with the appropriate boards.
Could I follow up? Mr. Rogoff, let me just go right back to the parking facility and ask kind of a yes or no. Will the FDA be involved in making sure that the number of spaces that are in the plan actually are executed in some reasonable amount of time?
Yes, we will, and we will also make sure that they're executed for the benefit, which is also an important issue for station parking lots, that those spaces are being used by transit users.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Just to follow up on the science earlier question on the value engineering, I assume one of the criteria will be that it not impose long-term life cycle cost penalties on WMATA.
Can I just address that?
Please.
When we do value engineering, we've been part of the design process all along. And to me, value engineering is just a normal part of the design process. We will be involved in that. And that's when you do value engineering, you look at both the initial cost as well as the life cycle cost. So we'll pay attention to that. Yes, exactly.
Yes, thank you. And Richard, just a couple of quick questions with respect to particularly the yard and shop facilities, the canopy and the construction, the steel versus concrete, and also the station finishes. Could you speak a little bit more to those points in terms of ongoing maintenance cost implications for WMATA? And I think I understood the explanation with respect to the rail yard, that the reshaping of that cost is so that it fits specifically to the cost associated with the line extension, and to the extent that we chose to enhance that facility to provide greater support for the rest of the system, that would be a WMATA-specific cost as opposed to the rail cost.
Yeah, thanks, Peter, for mentioning yard and shop. I skipped right over that. Biggest item. On the yard and shop, we have, from the beginning, I gather, always wanted the footprint of the area to accommodate the WMATA service when it's at full build-out, you know, run all 8-car trains and everything else. Well, that's not going to happen day one or probably even day five of the operation. And our view had been that we want the land, we want the layout done in such a manner that we can expand the yard in the future if we have to, but the yard itself initially should allow for take care of the phase one, phase two service. In the opening day and several years beyond that. So that was one aspect of it. And we had all really always assumed on our part that that's what it would be. As it turned out in the estimate, it was more of a build-out in there than was required from our viewpoint in the initial years. Second part.
So it was overscoped for or
well,
it was
the
more
money
than
was
it
provided
to
there to allow for the full build-out, okay, not required. We agreed with that. Second part was in the shop itself, in terms of the functions provided in the shop. After review of what was in the design, we agreed that there were certain component rebuild areas, basically, that are done at Greenbelt today, that would continue at Greenbelt, that in fact, it doesn't make sense at this point in time, again, in the startup of operations and several years after, to have a second component rebuild shop. We would have too much capacity, if you will, and we'd be spending money on that to maintain it. So what we did, and again, at a conceptual level, because we're only in preliminary engineering, we're not in final design yet, so we've got a long way to go. Conceptual level, we agreed that we'd reshape the shop to remove some of those component rebuild shops, because the function is going to be done at Greenbelt, but lay out the shop in such a way that we can expand it in the future. In other words, don't confine yourselves to a layout that would lead to a very costly expansion modification of the building in the future. So it was those two types of things that led us to agreeing to the reduction in the scope of this project.
The work specific to that line extension, though, would be done at that yard,
yes,
at Dulles, as opposed to at the Greenbelt yard.
What we do is, and what we want to do when we do at other yards, is you have a back shop that does component rebuilds.
Right,
when
right.
you need to change something on a car,
right.
you bring that component out to the outlying shop, and there's a change out. You don't do the actual component rebuild there. And that's the type of thing. We also reduced, I think, one track out of the shop that we didn't feel required. And Dave, if you want to add anything, that's fine.
Okay. As Richard was pointing out, again, we're looking at where we're going to be at right now in our life cycle costs versus whenever we look at the system, whenever we're 100% eight car trains. And, you know, again, that's going to be driven by our ridership profile. When it gets down to the day-to-day maintenance and everything else, we're really looking at kitting. We're changing the philosophy of the way that we're doing a lot of our maintenance as we're working these things. As y'all remembered also, we're changing our philosophy from a time-based maintenance to a mileage-based maintenance. We're running more actuals and such. And then sometimes when you do have these facilities, that we are dealing with a lot of specialized work areas where that equipment needs to be calibrated, maintained. You know, we have to follow very strict guidelines. There is a concern that sometimes you could spread yourself out a little bit thin on that. So that's very, very critical. And like I said, the biggest thing to stress is our involvement in the shop and in the yard layout, that if and when the time comes that we would have to go out to do any future expansion, as Richard pointed out, it would be as least disruptive as possible, you know, as that phase.
And thank you very much for those explanations. And if you could speak to 6, 7, and 8 as well, just in terms, particularly number 7, if that's more of an aesthetic versus an engineering modification, and also with respect to the canopy, what are the implications of that? What is that canopy related to? What is it covering? And then the final issue in terms of
the length of the canopy. In other words, in this design for phase 2, it was 8-car length canopy. We reduced it to 4 cars.
Yeah, at least 4.
4. And that is following the criteria that had already been agreed to and was under construction in phase 1. That's the change there. With regard to steel versus concrete, I'm an engineer. To me, it's one is as good as the other. It's what makes more sense economically. You can have pretty steel bridges and you have pretty, you know, concrete bridges. So that's strictly an engineering judgment, which one is cheaper in that particular circumstance. Station finishes was the last thing, and Dave probably can describe what Largo has more than I can, but we're agreeing to something that WMATA itself did as it looked to build Largo Station in terms of the station finishes. And what we're saying is it's okay with us if you do the same thing on Dulles Phase 1.
My question was more specific to the cost of ongoing maintenance, if the change in finishes has any implications in terms of our costs for ongoing maintenance and operations.
No. For example, you know, station finishes, one of our favorite topics is tile. You know, if we can get away from this small tile and go with stamped concrete or a larger type paver that's, you know, more industrialized and stuff, it's a cost savings for us, you know, immediately, as well as it provides a safer environment for our customers, you know, to walk throughout. So we would look at, you know, like Largo and some of the other areas, you know, while we understand that there needs to be concrete for canopies and aprons and piers and everything else, also using some of these areas where we're using stainless steel or some of these other materials that last for a long time are, you know, just as efficient, just as effective, and in some ways they're probably less subject to corrosion and everything else. You know, that's the other thing we're looking at is the treatment of these material and surfaces over our life cycle, taking advantage of our lessons learned to date, and especially what we're going through now, rehabbing and rebuilding the system, as you know. So we've definitely tried to capitalize that and take that as an opportunity at this stage.
Good question. So, I just want to follow up on the canopy issue because it matters for our customers. And the question I continually get is if we go from underground to above ground, you know, how do you simulate a better experience as best you can? And I see in here on item two, an infusion of $10 million to try to deal with the difference for the customer experience of underground versus aerial. And I'm trying to position that with the reduced canopy in number six to try to understand, first, is the canopy reduction only at the airport station, or is this will be at all?
All stations, and it's the same as phase one.
It's consistent with phase one. And so if you have a four-car train come in, all passengers will exit the train and be under a canopy. But if you have a six-car or a future eight-car, then potentially a third or half of those passengers are going to exit the train, and they're not going to be protected from the elements
Correct.
At all?
Correct.
And so how does that match up with number two?
Number two is addressing the amenities at the airport station only, where there's besides windscreens and that sort of thing, even heated shelters. So, again, it's travelers, people waiting, trying to provide some enhanced amenities consistent with the fact that the tunnel's no longer there.
Okay. And let me just follow up quickly on the canopies. Are these being built in a way that this is a reasonably easy future WMATA station modification, or are we going to run into a problem later where we didn't plan for the future canopy expansion, and now we're looking at a major cost-prohibitive capital project that requires us to tear the whole station up?
The new application that we're applying here will be much easier to expand upon versus what we have with the original system that's already been built in.
Okay.
I guess you could say it's kind of a modular type of approach where we're building in certain concessions and stuff to add segments to it instead of a superstructure that's built in place, standalone as is, and then all of a sudden you can't rely on anything, then you've got to build another structure, you know, to support that accordingly.
This item was brought in response to the Secretary, but also in the responsibility of the Board, in that the change of alignment is a responsibility of the Board, too, in our partnership with the jurisdictions. And so the proposal before us will be, if moving forward, refined and will be an adjustment to the approval that we granted years back.
Madam Chair, just before I sign out, I just want, on behalf of the Secretary, to thank everyone for their service on this board. Given all of the many challenges that the WMATA system faces and the service you turn out every day, the Secretary would want me to pass along his sincere gratitude as a regular user of the system. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Rogoff, and thanks to the Secretary, because I think the process has been very helpful. As you said, we all made sacrifices, and I think they were well to our benefit. Thank you. Mr. Downs, I will turn this over to you.
Thank you.
Finish your committee meeting.
Given the time limits and the agenda that we still have left, I would like to go to the elevator plan.
Mr. Downs? I do have one question about the cars, that I was holding, trying to wait towards the end. The 7,000K cars.
Mr. Downs, would it be okay? We might could be down here in about 5 or 10 minutes, just so we could complete the presentation on the 7K.
Okay. Okay.
Well, I can wait to the end of the presentation whenever you want to entertain questions. Okay, questions. My question is that, and I want to be real clear to everyone that, you know, that as much as you talk about color, we're not going to be seduced into talking about color as a board. So we're going to stick to policy questions, and we have currently a policy that welcomes bicycles and on our trains, and more as, you know, that the city and the surrounding jurisdictions encourage that as part of their transit option, that I'm wondering, will the cars accommodate bicycles? Currently, if you're going from here to out to the suburbs, there's no way to secure it. You have to sit there and hold it, and it's not the best thing for the other passengers. I know that on the Charlotte line that they have a clip where you can put the bike up, so that especially you're going longer distances, you can put that up there. Is there any discussion or proposal of putting a secure clip or rack for a bike?
We have been reviewing that quite extensively on the ability to figure out how to put a bicycle into a subway car. As you noted, in the light rail car, that's a low floor car. You've got a much higher ceiling across the board, and you've got a different envelope to work with. Since our car tapers at the top, it's not square like what Charlotte has or a lot of other rail cars. And the other thing is our ceiling height is lower, much lower. Whenever you simulate putting a bicycle up and trying to figure out how to hang it and everything else, it almost really, in some cases, really touches from top to bottom. That act or movement of trying to swing your bike around, stow it in a position, and let it be secured, and as far as it protrudes out and everything else, creates a big safety concern on our part, especially whenever you factor in the handlebars and then also your pedals that are protruding as well.
You got it. The question then really is, have we done anything in relationship to rail car design to accommodate our passengers that bring a bike?
There's a number of things that we have to accommodate with regard to the rail car design. WMATA has done an excellent job of making this system accessible. We have people with luggage coming through Union Station, Reagan Airport, someday Dulles Airport. We have people in wheelchairs. We have people with shopping. They're not carts, but whatever you put your stuff in, you go to Costco with large things. And what we, so it's we have to provide accessibility onto the car for all those people, including bikes. What we've attempted to do, and we can show it in the rendering here, is you end up with providing space for wheelchairs. And despite the fact that this system is well used by people in wheelchairs, a lot of cars run without, you know, people in that wheelchair. So you have a space there that's created by the door. And in that space, you can have people that will have put luggage there, large luggage, so they don't back, you know, clog up the aisles. You can have people come on with a bike and stand there with their bike and hold on to the handle, the bars that are there. So it's that sort of common space, open space, that can be used for people bringing bikes, wheelchairs, big packages, and that sort of thing. I will say from my own experience, similarly, on a light rail system that we built up in New Jersey, we put bike racks on one of the systems. And initially, starting out, and it was in the same location as where people would be with wheelchairs. Initially, people started out using the bike racks. For some of the reasons that Dave outlined, you're running into people, especially on credit cards, trying to put the bikes up, your problem. Eventually, people just didn't use the bike racks anymore. They left them on the floor, held on to the bar, and that was better for everybody because they weren't, you know, struggling to get things on a rack with a lot of people standing around them. So it's that common space, if you will, set aside. Priority goes to people in wheelchairs, but after that, it's really open. And you see the same thing happening on commuter rail cars and everything else. It becomes a multi-use space.
Just to finish this off, so in terms of 21st century design, best practice now is just multi-space. Okay.
Could I make a suggestion, though, in light of Mr. Wells' concern, which I think is legitimate? Bicyclists are authorized to be on Metro Rail cars, at least a meeting with WABA about the bike issues, potentially around the 7,000 car series, whether that deals any change in design or not. The process of consultation with users is a principle we all endorse, and if that hasn't been done, that I'd suggest a meeting with the bicycle community.
And for clarification, WABA, as everybody knows, is Washington Area Bicycle Association. Thank you.
Maybe the icon could get out. We're the world next to the wheelchair.
Okay, well, let me just cut short a couple of slides before this, and I'll just talk. So what we did is we took the best, and we took all the comments that we heard the from the two different, and we put them into one final design. You heard about the flooring preference, the screens, the lighting. Actually, the new cars, the comments we heard from customers, the new cars seem brighter, and in fact, they are. Because we use LED lighting versus the fluorescent lighting, so they are not as brown. They're blue and kind of a cool light, and somebody commented, it looks like it would be easier to read. So that was a positive. The seats, you heard quite a bit about the hand grip on the back, vinyl, luggage. We have space for luggage, and also accessibility group appreciated the fact that we now have a spot for service animals. Because we no longer have the pedestals for the seats. Also, we now have, in this next design, you'll see a we have highlighted and amplified the areas, so it's very clear about the priority seating marking. When the accessibility community went through the cars, they also noted that they appreciated the visibility of the emergency call button now. So that was good. The next slide. So we added, in response to the utilitarian comment, we added more color and some design features that really warmed up the interiors. We've personalized and made a different mark on our livery or the outside of the train, if you will, to create a theme that now carries through to the interiors and makes it more distinctive and really communicates more to the positioning of the car so that that's up, that gets to the uplifting, the forward-looking, inviting. And we called attention to the features that the customer said that they liked the most with a little design detail. The seat back design, we've done a little something there. The privacy screens that they were so positive on, as mentioned, the priority seating area. We also increased accommodation, we increased the aisle width, but it doesn't, it did not take away the width of the seats, so we were able to increase the aisle width, and I mentioned the designated the priority seating area. So with that, I will have Masamichi describe the design as to where we are.
Thanks, Barbara. As you could see, we settled on the blue theme in terms of general color scheme. Then we enhanced design, reflecting input from the customer research. Number one, as you can see, we increased the size of windscreen or privacy screen. So when you are seated here, your head is covered with the protective screen. We have Umata identity that reflects exterior, that we'll get to it shortly, printed on the transparent screen. Transparency is very important here. It's a safety issue. If you are sitting here, even though you're fully protected, you still would like to see in your peripheral vision, what's coming in from the door. So transparency is very important. Priority seat is clearly marked with differentiated color. You can see here, we are assigning dark blue to the priority seat, while other seats have different lighter colors. Priority seat also has clear icons to indicate what these seats are meant for. As Barbara mentioned, there's no pedestal. The dog can go in there, assistant dog. In between space, between the seats, we put the Umata logo. It's the subtle gesture to further identify the car with this specific system. Let's see, what else? Ah, yes, the color spot for marking the wheelchair area. The wheelchair users is the weakest, so in terms of design, we are really emphasizing that in terms of communicating what this area is for, but this is an open space. If there's no wheelchair users, it's a multi-purpose space for bicycles and other things. Yes.
Back to the prior slide, please, quickly. The symbol that's above the priority seating, and it may be that
yes.
It feels like it might want to be higher, that if someone who's inappropriately sitting there is sitting there, their head is going to cover up the symbol, and other, and if it were higher, just underneath the map, it might prominently be indicated to people that it is a priority seat.
We will consider that.
Thank you.
You can see the color scheme here. We have three different colors. The darkest one is assigned for the priority seats. Then the medium blue and the lighter blue are assigned for the transverse seats, creating sort of a gradation, which further contributing to make the space feel a bit bigger than actually is.
Yeah, I just wanted to, it's no question, but frequently on the cars, there's not enough indicators of not supposed to be smoking or drinking or eating, not smoking, nobody smokes anymore in the car, but drinking and eating. And I always complain about the fact that it's not obvious once you're on the car itself, no drinking or no eating. So I hope that you'll consider those in some of the signage you put for permanent signs in the cars.
So going to the exterior, responding to the desire for really identifying the car with Washington, D.C., we came up with this livery that is, maybe move to the, if you could move to the next slide. Yes, here you can see the bonnet as well as the exterior graphics. Bonnet, we try to make it really smooth, again, forward-looking, in terms of visual identity on the side. It's a combination of Umata symbol and the graphical expression of radiating or identifying the Washington is the capital of the nation. It's the center of many things. The fragments gather to the center. So this exterior identity is the abstract way to talk about how the Washington, what Washington is, and identifying a car with the city.
So our next steps are that we are going to further validate. I mean, this is a continuous process, as I mentioned before, constantly going back, constantly going back. We will be going back to our focus group participants who initially we tested designs with. We will show them where we are. We will also show them the livery. We have them sit in the seats, the prototypes. In addition to that group, at the end of July, we will have a prototype of a seat that we will move around, that we will have people actually come into the stations and ask them to sit. And we will have research surveyors there asking them what they think about the seat and the features. So the next thing would be that we would go to the final selection of materials guided by what we heard from the customers, and then we move to the final design into the full-scale mock-up. That's where we progress.
One very quick question, if at the end someone would summarize, for my benefit and everyone else's, what is our schedule, completion of design, entering into build, and then delivering into the system, and what will be coming into the system and when?
Okay. From a design standpoint, we will be looking at our full-scale mock-up and stuff in the first quarter, probably towards the latter part of 2012. But materials and stuff are already being, you know, bought and procured on that. So that's very, very critical for us to be able to set the rest of the production on board. As y'all are aware, right now we're also working with Kawasaki and looking at their overall schedule because of the March, you know, earthquakes and tsunamis and everything else. The schedule has us where the first prototype car sets of train sets will start showing up in July of 2013. So that could slip a little bit, you know, depending on what we get with Kawasaki on some of their vendors and such. So we have still a lot of work in front of us in a very short time for it.
Thank you. Hearing no further conversation, thank you for the presentation. And congratulations to the board for not deciding to pick colors and carpet and overheads and lighting. It's a step forward. First, I want to apologize to Andrea about vital signs. There are a number of serious issues that need to be addressed, or at least talked about on the vital signs report. We're simply running out of time to have that discussion at this committee meeting. There are some pressing questions raised both about the current decline in the vital signs indicators on escalators and elevators, and the outline of a resource plan that I think need to be brought to the committee today, and I would ask you to make that presentation now.
Okay. As y'all are aware, we came to y'all the first part of the year as part of the vital sign process, and also, you know, our ongoing capital efforts and just the struggles with our escalator and elevator equipment. One of the things is what does it take to sustain a compliance around 85%? Because our current or our past reports by VTX and other folks, it's about housekeeping, it's about maintaining the asset, because we can get the best piece of equipment in here, but if we're not maintaining it properly, it will not last, especially on the duty cycle of this. We go to the next slide, please. One of the things that we did comment during this time frame was we were going to be looking at and targeting what it would take for us to get up to 60%. We were in the 40% range, 30% range. At that point in time, again, working within our budget, within our resources and everything else, what we did is we pretty much pulled resources from other areas of the operation for elevator escalator. We halted campaigns, we moved some stuff around on elevators and such, and we put in a specific effort to see if we put certain number of individuals undertaking these tasks and stuff, could we actually make a push? And then also part of this process was what would happen whenever we relax that approach or man force, how would things trend? So pretty much effectively in the February and March timeframe, we were 60-65% on time. Whenever we pulled the resources away for the April and May timeframe, we dropped down into the 40s, upper 30s, and now we're kind of trending back up to 45 into the 50%. One of the things that we've been looking at also was that, and labor has been always referenced, we changed during this time frame, we've hired a lot of people. I mean, as far as filling those vacancies, getting those folks addressed. Another thing that was also took place is we rewrote job descriptions, not necessarily at our maintainer level, but from a management perspective. We're looking for solid electromechanical backgrounds as well, to start introducing maybe a little bit different approach to the elevator escalator configuration, because the model that we have right now is not as efficient as what we really think it should. So at the bottom of this, you'll see that, you know, basically we have everything filled other than the five staff that are, you know, presently under recruitment, and offers and stuff are going. Also FY12, you know, part of that, we already started the recruitment for the 10 additional positions that were discussed, you know, earlier on. The next slide, what it does is just gives you a snapshot of what we have on how we broke down the respective levels and where we would target these resources at. And I would also like to point out on the board action information summary sheet versus our PowerPoint, there's a discrepancy between 55 and 60. 60 in the presentation is the actual number. Okay. Next slide, please. Looking at this thing from a resource perspective, because we are at a very critical time, our target is 60 additional positions, as noted in the previous slide, for us to target at about 85%. There's been some questions to say, well, why don't you make it 100? You know, why don't you make it 90? At this stage, there's a huge cost whenever you try to gain maybe the last 5 or 10%. The other thing is with all of the aggressive rehab that we have that's taken place and overhauls and everything else, you know, some of the newer technology that we're developing or we're employing and everything else, that could have an impact as well. The other thing that we're also wanting to footnote at this time frame is that, you know, Dulles is right around the corner. We've got to look at and factor, you know, Dulles Phase 1 and Dulles Phase 2. 28 elevators and 27 escalators, that's part of that, part of the Phase 1 opening of that. Again, this doesn't have anything to relate with the current 60 that we're looking at, but we're looking ahead for our planning. Next slide, please. Some other current efforts that are very critical. Spent a tremendous amount of time looking at the past history here on how contracted services and how the in-house work transition. It's been passed back and forth, but it's also how other contracted services were measured. For example, as it talks into the review of our reporting criteria, I still stand beside that we are doing the criteria which is the most stringent, which is basically is related around the customer experience. When you look at previous reporting criteria, they didn't count whenever an escalator was down for planned maintenance. You know, and for my part, I guess it makes it look good on numbers, but at the end of the day, an escalator or an elevator that was being held out of service is not available to the customer. It's not running. It's not functioning. I think it should count against, you know, your overall performance. It's just part of doing this business. And I think it also brings forth that you can't mask your numbers on what you're really experiencing out there. Reviewing of other transit properties, you know, reporting criteria, staffing levels. We were looking at, you know, some agencies that go one technician for five escalators. Their escalators are only, you know, 50 feet long. You know, we have stuff here that's 200 feet long, you know, multi-drive to try to get a best industry practice on what's taking place there. Also, their criteria on how they do their reporting. A lot of them have, you know, contracted services out where they're looking to change as well, where their contractors get to count. They're not counted against if there's like a major capital project or if there's preventative maintenance. They basically, the contractor, that view that is scheduled. And so there's an industry-wide approach of looking at this to, you know, to really evaluate what's taking place here. Also, vertical transportation excellence, they've been out on site. We're hoping to have we'll do exactly the same thing that we did last time with the other report, is that whenever we get this thing in, we get it vetted and such. You know, it's something that we want to make available, you know, to everybody that's out there. I'd also like to also comment on, you know, looking at the stress a little bit more on the business models. What do we do for Dulles? You know, basically, there's opportunities out there for us to look at, you know, supported services or contract services to help augment, you know, what's taking place. You know, what can be done on our existing system is going to be still reviewed at this point in time, but it also what can we do at Dulles? There's a big concern on my part that the dwell time between our capital efforts that we're working on right now, where we're taking down a lot more escalators, which is going to increase or, it's going to show a decrease in our availability because we have to take out adjacent units, the sustained pace of that. But it's also a matter of the resources that we get these capital projects completed on time, instilled, and in place that are working and functional. And I'll give you an example of that. Everybody's aware of Foggy Bottom. Well, our next generation of escalator, we're targeting to start service on Monday, July the 11th. So that means that during this time frame when all this stuff is taking place, we've already ripped out the old escalator. We've already moved it over, relocated it. The District of Columbia has been really good in supporting us with the inspection and everything else, and we've got the criteria and everything else, and it's running. And then it's our expectation to be able to introduce the next generation of that escalator, then we start over on the next one, you know, moving forward. I do view that that is positive. The other thing that also is not listed here, I talked about the technology, the availability of what we can do to get out there and monitor what's taking place. We've got a very crude pilot right now, but it is connected to 9 stations where we have the ability remotely to monitor every elevator, every escalator from a standpoint, is it running? is it off, and is what direction and stuff it's working. The next thing behind this is basically to get the kind of technical information so we could deploy our resources real time. I cannot wait on a station manager or a customer necessarily to report the status of the pieces of this equipment. We're really elevating the real-time information, the real status condition, just like we would monitor our rail cars, our train control, you know, everything else, because it is so very critical to this system. We've actually, and the other thing with our recent shift pick that we just did, we've adjusted some of our other staff to kind of be able to judge on this technology base with real-time information, letting these folks know where things are down versus where we have to kind of cover in mass and you don't really know unless you walk upon it. And at this point in time, I'd be open for any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McKay.
Couple things. First, Dave, you might recall before we acted on the budget, I asked the question, do we have enough money in the budget to deal with escalator and elevator problems? And the answer was, we feel like we do. If I'm reading this report right, the rest of that answer would have been if you're satisfied with 60%. Because the way I read this, we have 10 new positions in FY12, 5 in FY11 that have to be filled, and if we fill those positions, that we will sustain 60% or higher. Why didn't we go to 85% in the last budget?
Actually, what we did, if you recall, on the adoption of the budget, we added more money in there in the capital program for escalators at the last minute, and $2.5 million. That's our rough feel that in terms of adding more staff, that's pointed out here, it's going to take a little while to build up, so that's roughly a half a year's worth of that buildup. So it was accommodated in the budget. I made the changes at the last minute. It was what the board adopted.
Okay, so we feel like we have the manpower allocated in the budget. Maybe the position's not filled, but yeah. We have the positions. We have them funded in the last budget to get us where? 85% or?
Yeah,
85%. However, however, the money's there. Okay. The question of is it just do you fill more positions, do you take another approach, is still something that we're dealing with, whether we modify the existing business model and how we maintain things. That will be informed by what I see from the VTX proposal, as I said, when 9 months ago or whatever, I wanted to see the audit, come back on how we had performed over 6 months, and then determine what changes we have to make.
Okay, and just two other questions. One, the 5 positions from the FY11 budget that aren't filled, did we just not advertise them quickly enough? Is this a specialized skill that's hard to obtain? Why are they not filled?
They are in the recruitment process. They are basically, technician level, type positions and supervisors. We had a larger reduction, or I should say a larger vacancy rate, where they had upwards of like 30-plus positions when Rodrigo came on as the general superintendent in December. So he's been able to whittle that thing down, dramatically, and we're working very closely with HR to get these positions filled as soon as possible.
The reason I ask that question is it drives home for me a concern in the first bullet under current efforts, where we looked at past history of contracted services. I'm not going to belabor this point because the board's talked about it to a level of exhaustion, but I'm not convinced sitting here that transition necessarily has provided better service. I think if you talk to the passengers in the station, I don't know that I could sell that to the passengers that we transitioned out of contracted services to in-house. And aren't you happy with the way the escalators and elevators work? And I know there's a whole lot of other factors, age and other things that have to be considered, but I'd sure like to see a little more detail as to what that review was and how firm we feel like this is a better approach than the old contracted services that we had.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Porter, did you?
Mr. McKay covered my concerns.
Hello. Mr. Giancola.
Yes, a couple comments and maybe for clarification. As we bring on the new escalators and elevators in the Dulles or the Silver Line, and the next several fiscal years. Are they, you know, are we buying quality escalators and elevators? You know, what's the type of product we're buying? And hopefully it's not the cheapest, because we've already had acknowledged in previous reports over the year that we've gotten some junk into our system over time. So that's one related question, so clarify that. And two, as we these escalators and elevators are being installed, are we putting in some sort of maintenance period where we can really evaluate maybe the company that's producing these to maintain them over a period of time and evaluate how well they can maintain their own product? And you know, is that in our equation and our thinking? So I just need some clarification and elaboration on those kinds of questions.
All right. For the Dulles, absolutely. We're looking at that time, whenever these units were purchased a couple years ago, you know, or at least set in motion the criteria, we're looking at utilizing the most recent industrial applications that we can apply or we can find on a escalator at this time. Again, to harden it for an industrial environment. For the model review, part of this review, I can tell y'all that from a standpoint is discussing, there are firms out there that do contracted maintenance that are, you know, that do this regular maintenance. We've been in discussions with various people with that to get a perspective, as well as other authorities, you know, experience. As well as talking with original equipment manufacturers, say for instance the people that actually make the unit. There's a lot of services and stuff out there that they are providing now that basically they all come in and they basically, you know, design it, they build it, they maintain it for X amount, you know, a certain period of time. So we are under discussions with that type of protocol, as well as a continued evaluation of what we find from VTX, what type of progress and stuff that we're making in parallel with the capital effort where we're, you know, rebuilding and working on these units, as well as, you know, Rodrigo's and the new management team just be employed the first 6 months to see how they react. And so we see this coming to a head very soon.
And just one other answer your question on the Dulles extension, those escalators, as I understand it, the construction contract also has a two-year follow-on service, which is, you know, almost a warranty.
Yeah.
I want to associate myself with the questions that Jeff asked about the past, and again, in this nature of being new and not having been told about the swings, it would be very helpful to have management's description of what they believe went on and what the benefits and the downsides have been. The second thing I wanted to do, Mr. Kubitschek, and we've had several conversations about the performance measures, the KPI, and I very much appreciate your view about what that KPI is telling the customer, that this is how many are actually out. Doesn't matter what the reason is, this is what your access to escalators is. On the other hand, I think that there's this other overlay on this whole situation we're in. We've talked about it before, of we're in a hole, we're trying to get out of the hole, and then there's going to be the new normal. And our customers, I think, need to understand what portion of being out is being in the hole versus what's the new normal. And I could imagine that in a system of this size with this many, there's some percentage, I don't know if it's 15%, I don't know if it's 10, that's always going to be out because you're doing regular maintenance, and we need to convey that message. But at the moment, the way we're doing it is everything's lumped together,
yes,
and people don't understand. You didn't talk about your customer communication signage. I don't know if that's part of the answer, but I think all of us have been feeling for the last several months that we're not communicating to the customer the important part of this, other than that we don't have enough running.
We got another picture. We just didn't have time to get everything incorporated into the PowerPoint. As everybody is aware, we have a lot of brown wood out there with a lot of construction sites. And so one of the things that it's not only the communication of why the escalator is out necessarily at the local location when it's not running, but it's also figuring out an opportunity to take advantage of posting information and taking the next step when we have these major construction areas. Barbara's staff has been a great supporter and is really helping us out. And so this is an installation at Union Station that's just started, and we're going to start taking it to elevating it to the next step. And she probably can speak a little bit more about it, because from an awareness standpoint, it's this environment on not only what's taking place, but maybe we'll give a little bit more global information, but it's also finding out what we can do at the local, the local escalator on why it's out. And one of the things that we also found out that was very interesting, just a kind of an issue we're working through, is there is a code jurisdictionally that we cannot put a decal inside the escalator, because they view that as the people will get distracted. And so we're working through that process. So we might be reaching out to some folks to say, well, they do it in this country or they do it in this area. Do you think that we could at least maybe, try to pilot that? Also, it's been a very interesting journey, even on the size of the decals that we're actually permitted to put on the exterior and what we can put on there. But I would, that's just my understanding. And like I said, Barbara has a little bit more.
This is the first step, and this was the very first one that, so this is the piloting of them. There are a series of 8 messages. And we're putting them up on the plywood, and they tell the story of why it takes long, what we're doing underneath there. In a clever way, they try to get attention. But we also are going to work with Dave and his team on making the plywood a little bit more visually pleasing against the background of the murals. Like I said, this is day one that these were placed up on Friday, so this is part of Metro Forward. And we also are working on the alligator gate sign. We have one for that. So as he mentioned, we'll be working with the team on the actual decaling. We'll help with the decaling, safety tips and so on for the escalators themselves. So this is step one. More are coming. This was just a pilot. We might want to make these larger. We were trying to get them at a size so that we wouldn't have to cut through them, but they were the standard size of the panels. So that's why you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 all the way around. So this also provides us another opportunity. I mean, we won't have the same 8 messages. We can do safety messages. And we'll be looking constantly for different themes and messages that we could do on these posters.
Could I also suggest that several handicapped, visually impaired folks have commented about the difficulty in a dim lighting environment of having, in effect, black walls? This just doesn't make any sense from a handicapped accessible.
Well, we were going to look at green, and we're going to look at blue, and we're going to look at some colors that are going to that would be lighter. Yes. Okay. And the green that's a part of this campaign is not dark green; it is a really light green. We have also a light orange that we have, so we can match it up to make it lighter.
And I would say that because we didn't acknowledge in the vital signs report, escalator system availability report is way under target, even after we adjusted the target to lower it. We're significantly under it, and all the trend lines are bad. We have to have a better answer for our customers, not just about preventative maintenance, but about availability. And I agree with Ms. Hines' need for a customer story. I would suggest that if there is an issue about the 60 additional positions, that the board's delegation changed at the last meeting, gave the general manager the authority within the current budget to reallocate resources to meet staffing requirements, that the general manager has that authority. And I would encourage you to feel free in this area to exercise that authority if you think this is one of those issues that the customer's needs have to be accommodated within the current year budget to do so. That's, I think, why the board created that delegation for the general manager to exercise. The other is a strong suggestion that we go ahead with the full-scale analysis of the requirements for contract maintenance of the Silver Line on phase one and phase two. I don't think there is anything that would preclude the staff from doing the full analysis now about the pros and cons, advantages, the time frame for making those decisions, how they affect warranty provisions in the acceptance of the escalators, the original equipment manufacturer's interest might be better served on the front end of this process by having that analysis done and have that come back to the board for at least some discussion in the public forum about contract maintenance of that new part of the plant, the 28 escalators, 27 elevators that we're adding.
Yeah, certainly we'll do that and intend to do that, but I'm also looking beyond that in terms of the business model and what we should be doing, because while I think we're making progress, we have to make it faster.
Any other questions on elevators and escalators?
Maybe I misunderstood. Monday, what's going to happen at Foggy Bottom? A new generation of escalators is going to start there. Is this the future that we're about to see Monday?
Yes, sir. It's the best piece of equipment that we could find out there. And I just brought it up because it's at least one glimmer of hope that, you know, things are coming together.
It's, better it, work.
Yeah. Well, trust me.
We can have a ribbon cutting, too. We can have a ribbon cutting.
I know. We're going to have a lot of people looking at it. It's you know, it's going to look the same from an external standpoint, but it's much different. Our OEM is going to be out there because they are very much aware that they are underneath a scrutiny. And while they like to display proudly their emblem on the piece of equipment, they won't even have to ask us, you know, who is providing this. So they're aware that there's a huge focus and a huge weight. But again, it's also very exciting for that station there because, you know, we're moving everything over, adding another set of stairs there for that station design, as well as putting in a canopy and stuff. And so the other component will be as soon as this one is up and running and going, that means that we'll be taking another unit down to get this work completed as fast as possible.
Mr. Giancola?
Does that mean we're not going to have a vital signs report today?
There's just no
time. Okay, let me just make a comment on it if I could. Certainly, there was a discussion of the bus on-time performance in there, and I certainly wanted to offer my support on page 30 of 97 about the change from the current measure to scenario A, which is shortening the late time from 7 to 5 minutes, and certainly from the current measure to 2 minutes to 1 minute for early time. I think I would support that adjustment, at least to evaluate and to look at.
Mr. Downing?
And I was disappointed to learn that that wasn't what we were doing.
Yeah.
That we were going to say that would be a nice thing to accomplish, but we're going to have to wait to accomplish it. I think it requires a longer discussion, maybe at the next meeting. But I don't think we can have both a relaxed standard and a low performance. Mm-hmm. My view, the standard should be what we owe to the customer, and our performance is how much of that we delivered. You know, I remember when Fred Smith started FedEx, he didn't say we'll get there by Tuesday. He said it'll be overnight. And And initially it was 90%, and then it was 95%, and then it's 99%. But I don't think you can have both a soft standard and a acceptable performance.
I would agree that it requires discussion, because underlying it, actually in some respects, we have a more rigorous standard. And that's why we have to have a full discussion of it. Yeah.
We'll put this over to the next one.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, we do have a need to do some governance work today, and I'm mindful of, thank you. It's 1 o'clock. I know there is lunch upstairs. I don't know whether the board would like to take 30 minutes and go up and eat and come down, and I believe we can do this in less than an hour. So I'm kind of looking at people's, I think fuel is a good idea at this point. So how about we come back at 1:30 for lunch, for governance, okay?
Yeah.